Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I was the first, one of the first. My first day was state trooper coming, putting me in the back seat of the car, and meeting the other black kids with six of us. And then seeing all of those parents and also KKK members having signs and throwing cans at us, spitting at us. We lived in the threat of death every day, every day. So I was just lost in this vacuum between integration and segregation and racism. That was my childhood. I was angry for years. Angry. Very angry.
The newest album from Solange Knowles is her most political and most commercially successful yet. It hit number one on the Billboard charts last month. Like her sister Beyoncé's recent work, Solange is exploring what it means to be black in America today. The songs on this album celebrate black culture, confront prejudice, and explore the trauma of witnessing black people killed. It's called A Seat at the Table. This is also her most personal work yet. The album includes interviews she did with her parents, and she wrote most of the song lyrics in a small town where her family has roots called New Iberia, Louisiana.
New Iberia is where my maternal grandparents are from. And there was a series of really, really awful events to where essentially in the middle of the night they got pushed out of town.
What was that about?
My grandfather was actually a miner, and there was a big explosion that happened. And they basically just kind of left him for dead. And my mother's cousins went and saved him.
They dug him out.
They did. So there were a lot of people embarrassed by the situation. It was kind of a town scandal. And it became a little bit of a race war. My grandparents, they fled to Galveston.
In Texas.
In Texas. One of the important reasons that I wanted to write the lyrics specifically there is because I wanted to reclaim that space. Basically say no one's pushing me out of town.
Fall in your ways so you can crumble. Fall in your ways so you can sleep at night. Fall in your ways so you can wake up at night.
When I say fall in your ways, so you can crumble, fall in your way, so you can sleep at night, fall in your way, so you can wake up and rise. That was really about honoring my lineage, my past. And that's why it's first on the album, because it's almost like a meditation to just prepare yourself to go through this journey. I honestly feel like when I hear that song, I can feel my roots. It feels very, very spiritual.
And so did you find by writing this that there was some kind of, I don't know, catharsis or healing or closure, or was that even what you were looking for?
It was. I mean, I wanted to honor my family by creating work that I felt that we could all heal from and have the conversations. But I also had a lot of personal healing to do, and I needed to empower myself. And I think that was really the goal.
Can we talk about Don't Touch My Hair? Because your mother was a hairstylist. I guess you kind of grew up almost in a hair salon. The cover art for this album, your hair is like this ornamented halo. Talk about the significance of this song.
Don't touch my hair when it's the feelings I wear. Don't touch my soul. It's a rhythm I know.
Black hair has such a significance in Black culture. The hair journey of a Black woman is so specific, and it's really hard. And your hair can send so many different messages to so many different people in the world that it becomes political, it becomes social. And I think that, you know, the hair part of the song is not just about hair, obviously. It encompasses a broader message for just Black empowerment. And I think my mother's interlude that happens before that song is so powerful. And I think that she articulates what I'm trying to say in a totally different way.
It's such beauty in Black people, and it really saddens me when we're not allowed to express that pride in being Black, and that if you do, then it's considered anti-white. No, you're just pro-Black, and that's okay. The two don't go together.
Her saying, allow us to be pro-Black, allow us to have that moment, just like the album, to really take pride and celebrate our journey and look at where we came from and look at where we are today. And so Don't Touch My Hair is really a moment to do that.
You created this album out of a personal need for self-healing, family healing, ancestral healing. And now it has hit number one on the Billboard charts, which suggests to me that a lot of other people needed the same kind of healing that you and your family and your ancestors needed.
Absolutely. I think that right now, this generation, we've been through a lot, and we are still going through it, and we are still fighting for our voices to be heard. And then we're fighting for action to happen after our voices are heard. And I think that it was important for me to not just having a platform to vent and cry and mourn. That's important too. But I also wanted to end this album saying, we have been chosen to go through this journey. If you believe in some kind of force that's with us, there has had to be for us to go through what we have been through for these centuries.
Nah, we come here as slaves, but we going out as royals and able to show that we are truly the chosen one.
And I think the best part about it is just feeling like through my healing that I might have reached someone else that really needed to hear this. And that's just been the most powerful part of it all.
I tried to drink it away. I tried to put one in the air. I tried to dance it away.
Solange, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you so, so much for having me.
The new album is called A Seat at the Table.
Thought a new dress would make it better.
got to work, work, work.
Everybody's talking about the white working class and how the Democrats need to speak to them, but I feel like people are forgetting that there's other working class people in America. They're black working class people.
Staying with businesses, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about manufacturing jobs. Over the past 40 years, about 7 million U.S. manufacturing jobs have disappeared. A new report from an advocacy group funded by both labor groups and manufacturers is saying that these losses have hurt many workers, but they've had a particularly dire impact on African Americans. The report is called Unmade in America: Industrial Flight and the Decline of Black Communities. The group also says that these negative effects can be turned around. They make suggestions to do just that through infrastructure investment, workforce development, and so-called worker-friendly trade policies. Here to tell us more about this is Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, and Gerald Taylor, author of the report. And we started by asking Scott Paul about what changed in American manufacturing.
What changed was really globalization and competition. And after 2000, we were competing with China head-on, combined with the fact that we've had much slower growth since 2000 than we ever had in the 90s or the 80s. And that lack of growth and the competition with China, and then the economic bet that we placed on the financial services sector to carry us through, really didn't pay off. And so that's why a lot of industry is in the situation that it's in right now.
Okay, Gerald, one of the things that you say in the piece is that the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, which is something that our listeners are very familiar with, is a direct result of the city losing so many manufacturing jobs with the decline of the auto industry. How is that?
So you look at something like the Flint water crisis, the common explanation of why this happened is that emergency managers were appointed to try and get the city out of the state of fiscal emergency that it was in, and they messed up. But when you ask the deeper question, which is why was Flint in a state of emergency in the first place, what you find is essentially the legacy of industrial flight in Flint. You know, in the 70s and 80s, Flint had a very booming auto industry. And then as this trend away from manufacturing employment was taking place, Flint lost a lot of manufacturing jobs. You know, I think since that booming industry, they've lost tens of thousands, like over 70,000 manufacturing jobs. And it kicks off this downward spiral where the city loses financial resources, can't keep up with its provision of public resources like infrastructure, police and fire protection, and things like that. And there's a downward spiral that happens.
So, Scott, let me ask you about, you know, you have recommendations to reversing this phenomenon. But I do have to point out that your organization is not neutral. It's a research group and it is an advocacy group. It's a combined sort of entity involving participation by manufacturers and the Steelworkers Union. By definition, your intention is to grow the manufacturing sector. So I do want to hear your recommendations, but I also need people to understand that they do come from a worldview.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would argue that our approaches are pragmatic. They're not philosophical. And I think that investing in infrastructure, investing in training, having a results-based trade policy would get broad support. In addition, I think we need a better system for both training and retraining, one that recognizes the realities of today, that it's probably not an 18-year-old kid. It might be someone who's transitioning at the age of 50. And at the same time, you know, we need a rational trade policy. We're not going to be ripping up our old trade agreements like Donald Trump.
But what does a rational trade policy mean?
A workers-focused trade policy that's going to create opportunities for them overseas, not just the big companies that do benefit from these right now. The benefits don't often come back to the workers in the United States. This administration has, I think, begun to do a good job of enforcing those rules, but we need to turbocharge that in order to give our manufacturing sector a chance.
Well, the argument I think that people have made on the other side is that that sounds good in theory, but that that actually leads is to stasis and a lack of innovation.
I'm not arguing for like a 50s assembly line nostalgic view of manufacturing, but I think that there are great opportunities out there, and there are going to be inventions that we can't even imagine 10 years from now. And the question is going to be, who's going to make those?
Okay, Gerald, before we let you go, we're down to our last couple of minutes here. Is there something that you mentioned in the epilogue to your report that you grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, and that you kind of witnessed some of these trends yourself firsthand? Is there something in the course of investigating this holistically as a research project that surprised you?
I think the thing that surprised me the most is that this pattern that we were talking about, this kind of downward spiral that can happen in a city when it loses its manufacturing base. But that's a story that can be told, you know, dozens of times. You know, you look at places, you know, like Detroit and Gary and Pittsburgh or Flint or Milwaukee and Baltimore, like all of these places which are so often the sites of economic distress and civil unrest now. They have stories like this. And that was one of the things that was really surprising to me is that, you know, Youngstown is not even close to rare in this way. It's a pattern that's played out over and over.
That was Gerald Taylor, author of the report Unmade in America, Industrial Flight and the Decline of Black Communities. We also heard from Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
I know you don't smoke weed. I know this. But I'm going to get you high today. Because it's Friday. You ain't got no job. And you ain't got shit to do.
But as far as white people trying to run some game on black people by legalizing weed, well, get that out your mind, buddy. Because, first of all, they're not legalizing that stuff where black people live, man. I don't know about where y'all living in, but places like Colorado, places like Alaska, places like Oregon, and, you know, they say D.C., but D.C. is being gentrified. Right now, black people are being pushed out of D.C. So, black people live in places like Florida. Black people live in places like Mississippi. You're talking about large amount of black people. Tennessee, South Carolina, and they're not legalizing that stuff there, man. So they ain't trying to run no game on black folks by legalizing marijuana.
Voters in California, Massachusetts, and Nevada voted to legalize recreational use of marijuana, while North Dakota, Arkansas, and Florida approved medical marijuana initiatives.
When Californians approved Prop 64, they didn't just vote to make it legal to smoke. The initiative also set up a framework on how pot will be grown, distributed, and sold in retail locations. And with billions of dollars in potential revenue, investors are already lined up to get into the legal pot game. Adam Bierman is one of them. He's the CEO of MedMen, an investment firm here in Los Angeles. Adam, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, your firm invests in marijuana grow operations and in retail locations, but before yesterday, where were you running your business?
Well, we run our business out of Culver City, California, right next to an NPR station.
Yeah.
But so we're based out of Culver City. I live in Marina Del Rey. We invest all over North America. So we invest in supply-constrained markets with high barriers to entry with large addressable population. So I think that, you know, everybody's very excited, as are we, about Prop 64 passing. You know, about a year ago, a series of assembly bills passed, creating a framework to legalize medical marijuana on a state basis in a commercial fashion. And so we started participating from an investment perspective in California at that time.
So how big of a change were Tuesday's result for your company?
They're tremendous, and I don't think it's just for my company, right? It's for the industry as a whole, and I think it's symbolic, it's real, and it's everything in the middle. I think for us as a private equity fund, you know, and we have limited partners that invest into our fund so we can invest into projects, there are a lot of money sitting on the sidelines that has been sitting on the sidelines looking to be deployed into the space now for a few years, and I think that the watershed moment really was Tuesday, and I think that, you know, the lead of that moment was California, and so the reputational risk, you know, the fear of what happens if, you know, everything gets unwound and we don't no longer have these medical marijuana programs or recreational marijuana programs, what happens to our dollars? I think that fear subsided to the extent where now you will see, you know, massive capital entering the space. You know, capital formation was starting, and I think this is really the moment at which it gets to, you know, a place of real consistency and size.
Adam, let's paint a picture of the landscape here, the business landscape. So what sorts of opportunities are there for people who want to open up maybe a small marijuana business?
Great question. And specific to California, I think in California there are going to be more opportunities than anywhere else in the world. The framework that's been created around California's legal marijuana program, whether it's medical or recreational, allows for literally over a dozen different types of licenses. And so there's room for the small mom and pop, you know, grow operation. Mm-hmm. And you will see very, very large institutional quality players like ourselves building, you know, multi-million dollar operations under a different license type. So every state has its own regulatory regime and framework. And in some states, there really aren't many opportunities at all, for that matter. And in California, there will be a lot of opportunity for pretty much everybody who wants to get into the space. I think the one thing that's worth mentioning is it's not just about getting a license, opening up a pot shop, right? Mm-hmm. What does this do to the legal community? What does this do to the accounting community? What does it do to the electrical engineers? What does this do to the, you know, there are so many different subsets of our economy that now will benefit from the fact that this is opening up, and they will participate or create a business line that participates in our industry.
Adam, where do you see the largest money-making opportunity?
Well, for us specifically as a private equity fund, we invest in the universe that is growing manufacturing and selling legal cannabis. So for us, it's in the real estate, and then the businesses on top of that real estate that are growing manufacturing or selling pot. And that's specific to us. And we're a $100 million fund, and we can make, you know, pretty sizable investments. So I think, you know, the answer is it depends on who you're asking. Everybody has their own investment thesis. Everybody has their own, you know, size that they can go deploy into a space like this. And again, whether you're mom and pop and you're trying to open a small store or start a small grow, or whether you're us and you're investing in $10 and $15 million projects, I think California will have some room for everybody. We're talking about a market that's newly been created that we project to be worth over $8 billion a year. There will be participation, you know, across a wide range of different people and different mandates.
And one thing, though, marijuana is still illegal at the federal level, and places in Colorado have been dealing with banking issues. What's your plan for dealing with cash? Because a lot of businesses have to deal in cash.
Yeah, and in California specifically, businesses have been dealing in cash, unfortunately, and that has to do with the fact that we haven't had state licenses. The Department of Treasury issued a memo a couple years ago as to how banks can bank this space. There is a way in which banks can bank this space, do so lawfully, remain, you know, compliant and in good standing. But one of the first things that has to happen is they have to have verification that whoever they're banking has a state license. The reason that you hear the tales of everybody, you know, with all their cash in California is because nobody in California has a state license. It doesn't yet exist, and it won't exist until 2018. So in California, I anticipate we will have plenty of banking options as soon as state licenses are issued, and these businesses will be run like regular businesses.
Adam Bierman is the CEO of MedMen, an investment firm here in Los Angeles. Adam, thanks a lot.
And in other news, a rare federal death penalty case is starting in Charleston, South Carolina today. Dylan Roof is the young white man accused of going into an historic black church last year and massacring 9 worshipers. Prosecutors say Dylan Roof attacked the churchgoers out of racial hatred. NPR's Debbie Elliott will be following the trial and joins us now from Charleston. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning, Renee.
This was a truly shocking crime, gunning down people as they were reading the Bible. What do we like to hear during the trial?
Well, this is the federal case against Dylan Roof, and federal prosecutors are going to try to show that he targeted Emmanuel AME to start a race war. The setting here was significant. They are saying that Roof, a self-avowed white supremacist, picked the oldest African Methodist Episcopal Church in the South for this horrible crime. That church, of course, known as Mother Emmanuel. He's facing 33 federal counts, including hate crimes, weapons charges, and a charge of obstructing religion. So if you recall, officials say the story was he was 21 years old at the time. He spent an hour with these people in Bible study and then methodically opened fire. Survivors say he told them, quote, "Y'all are raping our women and taking over the nation." He talked of being on a mission and told one survivor he was going to let her live so that she could tell the story of what happened. 9 people were killed, as you said, including the pastor of the church. 5 others were in the church and survived, 2 of them children.
And obviously devastating for those survivors and also family members of the shooting victims. What are they saying about the start of the trial?
You know, I think they're ready to see justice done, but they're also very ready to get this over with as well. I spent some time with Nadine Collier. Her mother, Ethel Lance, was among those killed in the massacre. And you may remember that dramatic moment when family members of the victims attended Dylann Roof's first bond hearing, and they all talked about forgiving him. And she was one of those who was just very poignant. She said, "Have mercy on your soul," as she looked at him and spoke with him. Well, she's been to every single court hearing since then, and she'll be there for every day of the trial, she says, if she can. But really what she wants is for it all to end. Here's what she said.
"You can't go nowhere unless you see, you hear about it, you, people talking about it, you see about it. It's everywhere you go. This have made history. But respect the family and let us grieve in our own way. We're not doing that. We're not.
As you hear there, Renee, the family members say they haven't had a chance to grieve. The problem is this is far from over. Jury selection is what's going to be going on this week and for several weeks before the testimony gets underway in this federal case. And then early next year, Roof will be on trial again on state murder charges, which also carry the death penalty. So the families and survivors are going to have to go through this all over again.
Well, it is unusual for the federal government in any event to seek the death penalty. It's been used with the Boston massacre, with the Oklahoma and Boston bombings. How has the Justice Department justified it here, given the states also pursuing the death penalty?
Well, you know, Attorney General Loretta Lynch has said the nature of the crime justifies the punishment. But there's been some criticism because Roof's defense attorneys have said he would have pleaded guilty in exchange for a sentence of life in prison. So critics, including civil rights groups and several newspapers and editorial boards, have said it's a waste of judicial resources and it'll be hard on the victims. But the Justice Department cited, you know, factors including Roof's lack of remorse and his expressions of racial hatred as they tried to justify the death penalty.
That's NPR's Debbie Elliott in Charleston. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
An act that he imagined would incite fear and recrimination, violence and suspicion. An act that he presumed would deepen divisions that trace back to our nation's original sin. Oh, but God works in mysterious ways.
And now a view from some African Americans in conservative South Carolina. NPR's Debbie Elliott spoke with voters trying to make sense of the election.
Ernestine Adams welcomes Sammy Tucker Jr. to her home in Camden, South Carolina, a small town just outside the state capital, Columbia.
Hey there.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, darling.
She's 82, a retired professor. He's 50, the local NAACP president, and was just reelected to the county council. Both are Hillary Clinton supporters, like 9 of 10 black voters in South Carolina. They're celebrating the election of Camden's first black woman mayor, but are more somber about Donald Trump's victory.
I was not surprised.
I was.
No, I was.
And I had to catch my breath, regroup, and figure out, okay, what just took place? How did this happen?
Exit polls show African-American turnout was down. That bothers Tucker.
I think a lot of us stayed home, that we did not come out and vote like we did for President Obama.
Ernestine Adams sees the results as a response to the first black president.
And I do think that it was white backlash.
She says the divide in the nation comes as no surprise.
I was disappointed because I thought in America we could rise above this.
For her, talk of making America great again is disturbing.
What I hear is return to the days when white people were in control of nearly everything.
Adams says she was glad to hear Trump talk of unity when he won, but questions why that message wasn't part of his campaign. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Camden, South Carolina.
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton.
This is not the outcome we wanted or we worked so hard for,
And I'm sorry that we did not win this election for the values we share and the vision we hold for our country. But I feel pride and gratitude for this wonderful campaign that we built together, this vast, diverse, creative, unruly, energized campaign. You represent the best of America, and being your candidate has been one of the greatest honors of my life. I know how disappointed you feel because I feel it too. And so do tens of millions of Americans who invested their hopes and dreams in this effort. This is painful, and it will be for a long time. But I want you to remember this. Our campaign was never about one person or even one election. It was about the country we love and about building an America that's hopeful, inclusive, and big-hearted. We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought. But I still believe in America, and I always will. And if you do, then we must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it. It also enshrines other things: the rule of law, the principle that we are all equal in rights and dignity, freedom of worship and expression. We respect and cherish these values too, and we must defend them. And let me add, our constitutional democracy demands our participation, not just every 4 years, but all the time. So let's do all we can to keep advancing the causes and values we all hold dear, making our economy work for everyone, not just those at the top, protecting our country and protecting our planet, and breaking down all the barriers that hold any American back from achieving their dreams. We've spent a year and a half bringing together millions of people from every corner of our country to say with one voice that we believe that the American dream is big enough for everyone, for people of all races and religions, for men and women, for immigrants, for LGBT people, and people with disabilities, for everyone.
Shock and awe. I didn't see this coming. The words I never thought I'd say, President Trump, have become reality. In a remarkable campaign full of bile, hatred, fear, and loathing, guess what? Fear won. Hatred now gulps a glass of champagne. This campaign has been marked by scenes we have never seen before, by words we've never heard said on TV or radio, by screams about a rigged system, folks. When a billionaire shouts about a rigged system, you better believe it, because it is, but in his favor, not against him. Donald Trump has received billions of dollars in free cable and media coverage, which lifted his campaign from farce into solidity. After every campaign stop, the strains of a song, "You can't always get what you want," was heard. It is now clear, you can't. Today, a new day dawns on America as a curtain falls over the Obama presidency and Clintonism. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Donald Trump's victory last night surprised many. So how did he do it? Joining me now to talk about that are NPR political editor Domenico Montanaro and NPR's Asma Khalid, who covers demographics for us. Good to see you both.
Hi, Robert.
Asma, let me start with you first. After Mitt Romney's loss in 2012, one of the big conclusions of the Republican National Committee's so-called autopsy, examination of what went wrong, was that it was no longer possible to win the presidency just with white voters. It seems like that turned out to be not so true this year.
That's right. And part of that is because although the minority share of the electorate is growing, the electorate is still overwhelmingly white. If we look at the exit polls from last night, about 70% of voters were white. And Robert, I think what we saw sort of as a big divide, and you could say was sort of a key point for Donald Trump last night, was how white working class voters decided to cast their ballots. So if I can give you some perspective, in the 1990s, when Bill Clinton ran for president, blue collar whites were pretty much evenly split between Republicans and Democrats. Last night, Donald Trump won this group nationally by roughly 40 points. And that was even key if we look at states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa. Those three states, Barack Obama seemed to do well. He seemed to win the white working class vote in 2008. All three of those states, the working class vote went for Donald Trump last night.
And it's a big group. Mm-hmm. It's a big sector of the electorate. Domenico, what happened to Barack Obama's winning coalition of voters from 2008 and 2012?
Well, suffice to say, they were not fired up and ready to go, Robert.
Yes, I remember that.
You know, Clinton didn't turn them out. Turnout was down overall, but far more for Hillary Clinton. You know, at this point, Donald Trump has gotten fewer votes than Mitt Romney did in 2012. So, and most of those voters, or many of those voters, were from this Obama coalition. Young voters, African-Americans, Latinos, key places like in Milwaukee, off by 50,000 votes for Hillary Clinton. She wound up losing by 27,000 for the entire state of Wisconsin. In Michigan, Wayne County, where Detroit is, she's off by 80,000 votes compared to Barack Obama, and she lost the state by 11,000 votes.
These are
overall
places where she won, but not by a big enough margin to offset
exactly
the losses elsewhere in the state. Asma, let's talk about women voters. How did Hillary Clinton do with that group?
Well, there was an expectation that Hillary Clinton would win women, and she did do well with women, you could say, collectively. But she did not win white women as a voting bloc. And I think what was really interesting is some folks looked at college education levels. She did seem to do well. She seemed to win white college-educated women, but not by huge margins. And in particular, you know, the college education vote, I think, surprised a lot of folks. We had seen in the polls leading up to this election day that she seemed to have an edge with college educated voters. But we saw that men in particular, white college educated men, overwhelmingly supported Donald Trump.
And look, non-college educated men is going to be the big key here. But, you know, don't overlook non-college women. I mean, mm-hmm, a lot of Tea mm-hmm. Party supporters, when I went to a lot of those rallies that I covered then, you had people showing up at rallies with AstroTurf cut out over their bodies and saying, you know, we're not AstroTurf, we're grassroots. So they were fired up as well.
Let me ask about another group, and that was the Latino vote. Was there a true surge of Hispanic voters before Election Day?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that you could point to specific places where we may see a fundamental realignment. Places like Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, Texas, even Georgia, you saw an increase. Texas, for example, you know, the vote was within 10 points for the first time in 20 years. Part of that is because of the Latino vote. So we may be seeing a fundamental political shift in this country where you have Latino voters moving slightly more toward Democrats and in bigger numbers as they demographically move into the electorate. But Hillary Clinton still didn't get enough of them to put her over the top overall.
But you're describing one part of a shift. You're saying there could be more Latino voters giving the Democrats more strength. But if there are more white working class voters voting Republican, that might counteract that.
For the short term, I think it will. I mean, the white working class vote is a shrinking part of the population. The Latino electorate is growing. But Robert, one thing which was very interesting to me that may tie in a bit to the Latino vote is that we saw young voters not support Hillary Clinton with the same sort of vigor or enthusiasm as they came out for Barack Obama. And we know that Hispanics are overwhelmingly a young population. But last thing is, I think we will get a better picture of Latino turnout when we see the census numbers. A majority of Latinos did not participate in 2012. We'll see whether or not a majority voted this year.
Okay, that's NPR's Asma Khalid and Domenico Montanaro. Thanks to you both.
Thank you. Welcome.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
To reactions to Tuesday's presidential election and how they're playing out in schools around the state. With tension reported in some cases as students bring differing views to class, racist graffiti Wednesday at Maple Grove High School is one extreme example, but it's unclear how often tension is boiling over into action. Solveig Wastved's been looking into it and has this report.
Messages including "whites only," "Trump train," and the N-word were scrawled on a bathroom door at Maple Grove Senior High Wednesday. The district reacted, starting an investigation and getting the police involved. And the next morning, a parent told NPR that her daughter found students smiling and handing out cookies when students arrived, along with messages of acceptance posted on the wall. The smiles and cookies are a step toward healing divisions, but they certainly won't solve a problem that is not unique to Maple Grove. Students around the state are struggling with divisions that mirror the country's deeply divided voting age adults. Nora Tycast teaches band at Spring Lake Park High School.
My colleague and I both see just a wide gamut of reactions from students. Students that are really sad and scared, and students that are really excited and pleased. So on Wednesday morning, we saw a lot of fist pumping and really feel kids really feeling free to express their excitement and kind of their pride in the country in a bunch of different ways. And we also had some students that were a lot more subdued.
Tycast says she didn't see an increase in racist incidents post-election, but she says the school routinely struggles with racial tension. And it's unclear how many incidents similar to Maple Grove there may be. The Minnesota Department of Education says it's gotten 3 calls about incidents of harassment in schools. NPR News looked into a report of white students intimidating Latino students at Jefferson High School in Bloomington. The district says it's investigated the report and denies that physical intimidation happened. But shy of explicit incidents, it's undeniable that some students are dealing with anxiety. Administrators in several districts sent letters home encouraging civility and denouncing racism and harassment. Amy Hewitt Olatunde teaches English language learners at Leap High School in St. Paul. She says all her students are immigrants or refugees, and many of them are fearful.
Many of them think that they need to think about where to go. If they go home, if they don't have a place to go home to, what should they do? Their parents are also extremely fearful of what may happen in terms of retaliation.
Higher Ground Academy, also in St. Paul, has a primarily African-American population. Teacher Catherine Isley says she's sensed fear among her students since the primaries.
I had 3 kids come up to me yesterday going, am I going to get deported, like quietly in the halls, not in front of everybody.
But on Thursday in civics class, Isley is teaching her students how the American government works. And she's teaching them how to debate ideas.
Let's talk about some of those words we can use to disagree with people. What are some of the phrases and words you can say when you disagree with somebody?
Isley says students have been split throughout the election on policies. For Layla, a 10th grader, Donald Trump's views don't worry her too much.
It's not like he's going to make every single decision. He has a cabinet behind him, and they're going to help him make good decisions.
Another 10th grader, Adar, feels differently about the president-elect. She mentions that she's afraid of an increase in hate crimes following the election.
I am worried about his supporters because he brought all the racism has existed, for a long time in our history. But I feel like he brought all the racists out, all the sexists out.
But Adar says she's not worried about being deported. She's been paying attention in civics class. I know my rights, she says. Covering education, I'm Solveig Wastved, Minnesota Public Radio News.
So how's the college responding to this incident?
We're having a race forum.
And what's that?
A forum on race, so we can discuss the incident and the surrounding issues of race.
So the usual lip service.
No comment.
There was a lot of rude and negative comments towards Latinos.
Unexpected election fallout in Utah schools. Some minority students say they're being harassed. And it's not one school or just one case.
That's right. Fox 13's Matt McDonald is at Kearns High School tonight with the story. Matt.
Hey, Bob and Hope. I'm sure we can all remember the halls inside a high school. They can be a tough place, but perhaps a little tougher for some students the day after the election. Several Latino and Muslim students say not just here at Kearns High School, but it's at schools all across Utah are suddenly finding themselves the target of discrimination. Angelica and Eileen Gomez, a sophomore and senior at Kearns High School, share almost everything.
This is what sisters do.
The day after the election, they shared something new at school.
You wetbacks need to go back to Mexico. Hey man, you get a free trip back to Mexico, you should be happy.
Racially charged comments referencing Donald Trump's presidential win. It's not just Kearns High School.
We've had a complaint of a kindergarten student being harassed by a fellow kindergarten student and up to the high school.
It's not just comments, it's fear.
One of the little kiddos in our elementary school indicated he didn't think he'd be back at school the next day. And when they asked him why, he said, well, because Donald Trump was elected president, and I may have to go back to Mexico.
Canyon School District spokesman Jeff Haney says school psychologists are working on material for teachers to use to talk about election fears. But some lessons don't start in the classroom.
And because they hear their parents saying offhand comments in the privacy of their own home, they might think it's okay to take those statements to school.
The result, when it's heard walking down the hall,
it's fear and anger and frustration.
It's not the lesson they wanted to learn, but with each other to hold on to for support, it's not the last lesson they'll take away.
I want my voice to be heard and for Mexicans not be afraid of like standing up for themselves. I know I'm not the only one living in this state of anxiety.
Canyon School District said they had at least two separate schools call and ask the district for a little guidance in dealing with election questions. As for Granite School District, they're looking into possibly four cases that could or could not turn out to be harassment. And in fact, we got a note into our newsroom that the same type of thing had happened at a school in American Fork. At Kearns High School, Matt McDonald, Fox 13 News, Utah.
Remember, no one is going to treat you special just because you are black.
And a high school in the Lehigh Valley is being rocked by racist behavior tonight. Action News reporter Bob Brooks is live at Southern Lehigh High School in Center Valley. Bob, what's the situation there?
Well, Jim, good evening. I can tell you this is a school and really an area that is stunned by some of the things that have been said and done here. Most importantly, they are very hurt. And now it has gotten to the point to where the school administration has stepped in, they've intervened, and they're taking action. Racism at their high school by some of their students. This is something a lot of neighbors around the Southern Lehigh High School are having a tough time coming to grips with.
I'm very disappointed.
Oh, I think it's horrifying.
The outrage over what's detailed in a letter sent out by the school principal via email and published in a local paper. It talks about how students shouted racist slurs towards black and gay students down the hallways, in the gym, and at lunch. Also calling black students cotton pickers. Swastikas are being carved into bathroom stalls, and some students are accused of giving Hail Hitler signs.
We need to be educated about how horrifying that is.
Donna Solov says her husband is Jewish. Reports of a student hailing Hitler makes her sick.
You have no idea what it's like to be taken from your home, taken from your job, your family split apart, and somebody saying you're not worthy, you must die.
Students tell us the school held an assembly last week to address the issues. The email sent by the principal partially reads, I'm asking that you have some of these conversations with your child at home in support of what we're trying to do with the school. It's my hope that our students will do a better job of respecting one another and accepting each other's differences. We spoke with a few students about what in the world is going on.
This is terrible.
It's awful.
How can you say something like that?
They should be punished somehow.
The reaction of this woman named Rochelle when I let her read the letter says it all about the hurt this has caused this community.
My God. I don't believe it. I'm like incredulous. I really am.
And there you can hear some very hurtful reactions from those people. Now, the students I spoke with want to reiterate the fact that They think this is a very small number of students who are doing this. This does not represent a large portion at all of the student body. And again, they are as disgusted as anyone about what has happened. For now, reporting live in Center Valley, Bob Brooks, Channel 6, Action News. Jim?
Thank you, Bob.
This was a white lash. This was a white lash against a changing country. It was a white lash against a black president.
Damn you, Obama.
This week, we've been working on a show about what else? The election. We're going to look at the secret Trump voter. People who are in plain sight that might not have identified as a Trump voter outside the voting booth, but inside voted for him and shifted the trajectory of American politics. We're going to dig deeper into what they're looking for from President-elect Trump. We're also going to look at efforts around the country to prevent people from voting. We're going to bring you that show this weekend, but today, we wanted to play for you an extended version of one interview I did for that show. The day after the election, I talked to Richard Spencer, an American who's both thrilled and surprised that Trump won. I mean, a lot of people were, but Spencer is different. He's a white nationalist. He heads up a small group called the National Policy Institute. Spencer sees Trump's election as the first solid steps towards a new post-America whites-only nation. Might not happen in his lifetime, he says, but he can start to lay the groundwork now that Trump has won. Spencer was in Washington, D.C., tired after a long election night when we spoke. So, Richard, it's the day after Donald Trump won the election. I think so many people were surprised. Were you surprised by it?
I was surprised, and I didn't believe it, and I'm not sure I believe it even right now. It's all a little surreal. I mean, I thought that I thought he had a much better chance than people were giving him credit for. I thought it was a much better chance than, say, the 5% chance that the Huffington Post or the New York Times gave him, or even like the 25% chance that Nate Silver was giving him. I thought he was going to bring in new voters, and I also thought that there were a lot of shy Trump voters out there. But even I couldn't believe it when it happened. I was with a friend. We were actually at the Trump Hotel on election night, and that was a lot of fun. We were just walking around town, and we were both kind of like pinch-us. I'm not sure it's real. So it's been quite a day.
So now that your candidate has won, what do you see the future of America being? Because, you know, I feel like Trump winning means that kind of all bets are off. Like everything that people may have thought was going to happen the day after and from here on after can be shifted at this one moment in time. So I'm curious, like for you, what does the future look like? Or what do you hope the future looks like?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I don't think this was just an unusual election with an unusual candidate. I think this really was a paradigmatic shift. The new paradigm that Donald Trump brought into the world was identity politics, and in particular, white identity politics. And this question, which he asked directly, are we a nation or are we not? And defining his political message, not on conservatism, because, I mean, Trump is not a conservative in the way that self-described ideological conservatives understand that term. His starting point is not freedom and liberty. His starting point is not tax cuts. His starting point is not an aggressive democracy promotion foreign policy in the Middle East. His starting point is nationalism. Are we a nation? Are we a people? Or are we not? And again, this is something that his critics said, oh, this won't play. This is too toxic. It's too awful.
To you, when he says this
will never work, but it worked.
To you, when he says, are we a nation or not, does nation mean specifically white people? Because when I hear, are we a nation or not, I hear him say all Americans. That's what I'm listening for. But is that coded language and it says something different to you?
Well, obviously, there are people of other races who are United States citizens, they're here. But what really defines the American nation? Is the American nation just defined as a kind of economic platform for the world? Is the American nation just purely defined by the Constitution and some legalisms? No. The American nation is defined by the fact that it is derived from Europe, that European people settled this continent, that European people built the political structures, that European people influenced its architecture, its economy, its art, its way of life, and society, and so on. So America, I agree, of course, there are many different people here. But which people truly defined what America is? Well, now, obviously that could change.
Let me respond to that, though, because mm-hmm. I would say that every culture that came to America helped shape America as it is now. It was all the people that were here that created what America is.
Well, that's certainly true to a certain extent. But I would say that white Americans, European Americans in particular, Anglo-Saxon Americans, Anglo-Saxon Protestants, were this essential historic people, that they defined it in a way that no other people did. So, of course, African Americans have influenced American culture and American identity. Of course, Asians have and so on. But it really was Anglo-Saxons who truly defined it, who made America what it is, who are indispensable. There are other people, you know, other races in all sorts of other different countries. But there has to be that founding people, that indispensable people that really makes the country what it is.
I disagree with you completely, but I'm going to go past that because I want to get back more to your idea about what the future is going to be. Because if you see America as a place that was predominantly created by white people and for white people, which I'm not sure if I disagree with the for white people, but I would definitely say if you see that as what America has been, is that where you see it going?
To be honest, that's not where I have seen it going. Over the course of my lifetime, I've experienced something that is quite the opposite of this notion of an America of and for white people. I have experienced a great transformation of the American nation and American culture and society. I've certainly experienced through immigration a move towards multiculturalism and multiracialism. But there is a moral component to it as well, where we live in a world of a white guilt complex, where if a non-white actor is hired for this new movie role, or more non-white applicants apply to this college, or there's a new non-white CEO of this major corporation, that's thought of as inherently a good thing, morally speaking. We need more of that. We need less white people in positions of power. We need more non-white people in positions of power. So this has been my experience. I'm 38 years old. I was born in 1978. This has been my experience of America. It has not been, the arrow has not been pointing towards a country of and for white people.
I guess the point that I would make there is that, like, if you look at the numbers, majority of the power in this country is controlled by white people.
Yes.
If you look at Hollywood, if you just look at Hollywood right now, like, majority of the films that are being made star white people. If you look in colleges and look at the admission rates, like, you see majority of that is white people. And I think that what you're talking about is that, you know, the world or the country is trying to find a balance where everybody gets a seat at the table, where it's not just so white people get all of this stuff and everybody else gets left into the corner. You know, I hear this argument a lot where I hear people talk about things like there's BET, Black Entertainment Channel, and people wonder, like, why isn't there a white entertainment channel? Mm-hmm. But every time I cut on the TV and look at just any TV station, majority of what I see is white. So therefore, like, there already is a white entertainment channel. We don't need a white caucus in Congress because most of Congress is white.
I think there's a certain degree of truth to what you're saying if we were living in, say, 1965, but we're not living in that world anymore. Yes, white people are generally better off than many other people. But again, the question really is, which way is the arrow pointing? All of these institutions are not acting on behalf of white people. They are acting on behalf of non-white people. And you can talk about this being fair or what have you, but I will be brutally honest with you. Fairness has never been really a great value in my mind. I like greatness and winning and dominance and beauty. Those are values, not really fairness.
So Donald Trump is your perfect candidate.
Yes. I don't think Donald Trump is me. I don't think Donald Trump is alt-right. I don't think Donald Trump is an identitarian, as I would, use that term. I think Donald Trump is a kind of first step towards this. He's the first time that we've seen a genuinely, if you could say, incomplete politician who's fighting for European identity politics in North America. This is the first time we've seen it.
How do you maintain it, though? Because the numbers are going against you. Pretty soon, white people are going to be the minority in America, like in the next, what, 40 years?
Yes. By 2042, if nothing else changes, white people will become a minority. Also, the majority of births right now are actually to non-white people. So there is a dramatic transformation taking place. Now, what is going to happen in that? Are we going to all, in 2042, are we going to all decide, oh, well, you know, race doesn't mean anything anymore. Identity is meaningless. We're just all atoms here in the United States, and we all go shopping at the same store. We just have different skin colors. No, I don't think that's what's going to happen. I think whites are going to be, they're going to have an amplification of their consciousness of being white, that this whole process we're experiencing is not going to bring about racelessness. It's going to bring about a new consciousness amongst white people that actually wasn't there before.
So what happens with that consciousness?
Well, it's not necessarily, look, it might not be about maintaining an all-white society. I don't think that I could snap my fingers and we could go back to 1965 before the Major Immigration Act, or LBJ, that really dramatically changed the country. I don't think that. But what I think the only way forward is through identity politics. And the only way forward for my people, for us to survive and thrive, is by having a sense of identity. And I don't know what the future is going to hold, but we need that.
So earlier when you were talking to our producer and reporter, you talked about that you wanted a white ethnostate. Is that the end goal, the white ethnostate? Because I guess, like, I don't understand how you get to a white ethnostate if already you're beginning to lose the numbers.
Right. The ideal of a white ethnostate, and it is an ideal, is something that I think we should think about in the sense of what could come after America. It's kind of like a grand goal. It's very similar to in the 19th century when the left had ideals of communism. It was politics is the art of the possible, but philosophy is kind of the art of the impossible, so to speak. So they were imagining a new society, and at some point they brought it into being. A similar thing could be said of Jews in the 19th century who were imagining Zionism. There's a Jewish state in the Middle East. That was impossible. That did not exist.
Richard, respectfully, man, like, so are you saying that, like, America has to end in order for your ethnostate to happen? Because if you are trying to have a white ethnostate, what you're basically saying is that you have to forcibly remove people. Because I got to tell you, like, I'm African-American and I'm not leaving.
I don't. This shouldn't be taken as a cop-out. But the fact is, I don't know, because I don't know what history has in store for us. I don't know how history is going to unfold. What I do know is that for my people to survive, we have to have a sense of who we are. We have to have identity, and we don't always have it. We don't have an ethnic racial consciousness. Now, in terms of an ethnostate, I don't know how that will be possible. I mean, for leftists in the 19th century, the communism seemed just downright impossible over and over again. But history presents opportunities, and it becomes possible. So the ethnostate's not going to happen next week. It's most likely not going to happen through Donald Trump. What the ethnostate is an ideal. It's a thing. It's a way of thinking about, we want a new type of society that would actually be a homeland for all white people, all European people. So that would include Slavs, that would include Germans, that would include Latins, that would include people of all ethnicities, that we would always have a safe space. We would always have a homeland for us. Very similar to how Jews conceive of Israel.
Sure. Are you going to do that in Europe?
Again, I'm not trying to. This is not a cop out. I don't know. All I'm saying is that you have to dream it before you can build it, and we have to have this idea in our mind. I don't know where it will happen because I don't know how history is going to unfold. All of this stuff might very well not happen in my lifetime. But the thing is, I know that in my lifetime, I'm going to have opportunities to fight for the survival of my people and my civilization.
You, I've done some reading on you, research, and watched a couple of videos, and you're a handsome guy, man.
Thank you.
And you're well put together. You're really smart. I'm actually enjoying like having this conversation with you. But what's the difference between you and the racist that, like, you know, hung people up from trees? What's the difference between you and the Klansmen that burned crosses on people's lawns? What's the difference between you and, you know, the people who don't look at me, an African-American man, as a full human being? Like, what's the difference?
Well, I don't think it is the same old thing that you've heard before. I think you just said that it's not, that you're actually intrigued by it. I don't, you know, look, I'm not going to comment about, you know, some hypothetical Klansman or whomever.
There's no such thing as a hypothetical Klansman, because the people that I'm talking about exist. They have gone out. They have burned crosses on people's lawns. They have lynched people. They've done horrible, horrible things. They are the first American terrorist. So it's not hypothetical. I'm not comparing you to this thing that I'm just dreaming up. I'm comparing you to history. And I'm not intrigued by your ideas. I'm saying to you that, like, your ideas sound just like them, except you wear a nice suit and you can speak to me directly. And I respect that about you. I respect that you and I can have this conversation, mm-hmm. That you're not wearing a hood, but it's the same thing. And that's what I'm asking. Like, what is the difference?
I'm sure there is some commonality between these movements of the past and what I'm talking about. But you really have to judge me on my own terms. Like, I'm not those people, and I don't fully know. I don't know in the specifics of what you're referring to. Like, I am who I am. And you, if you're going to treat me with good faith, you have to listen to what I'm saying, listen to my ideas. I think someone who would go down the path of becoming a Klansman or something in 2016, I think that is, that those people are very different than I am. It's a non-starter. I think we need an idea. We need a movement that really resonates with where we are right now.
Richard, how are you different from them? Because you are talking about a white ethno state. You are saying that white people don't have space in this country. And I heard the interview with our producers. And one of the things that you said is that you were going to be able to talk to people of color about going along with your white ethno state. And so you've got a person of color right now. Talk to me about your white ethno state.
Let's not talk about the ethno state. Let's talk about identity. Who are you? If I say that, don't think about it. Just answer. Who are you?
Sure. I'm an African American male that has four kids. One of those kids is a white kid. I adopted him. He has no black blood in his body at all. He is the apple of my eye. He's my 16-year-old boy, and I love him to death. I have a child that's biracial, and I have two black kids. So I'm a black man who has love in his heart for everybody on this planet, including you. So that's who I am. Who are you?
I'm Richard Spencer. I'm a European person. I'm part of this great story of Europe and our history. I was born in Massachusetts. I grew up in Texas. I like mountain biking. You know, what I'm getting at is that when I ask you that, even despite the fact that you have, you know, I guess a white wife, perhaps, or a white child, you still answered that I'm an African-American male. And that has meaning for you. And I respect that. If you ask your average white person in America, who are you? They are going to probably never get around to talking about their European identity or their heritage. They're afraid of it. They know it. Everyone's kind of racially unconscious. They know it in their bones, but they're not conscious. They don't want to really talk about it and explore it and think about how that inflects their life. So that's what I want to bring. I respect your identity. I respect the fact that you think about it seriously, that you take it seriously. I want white people to take it seriously. In terms of what I was talking about, of like, we're going to do this together, I think that I want to see an identitarian future. I want to see different peoples, different civilizations having a sense of themselves and finding out ways to live together.
But a white ethno state is not people living together. Like, what you're saying to me now is different from what you said before, because what you said before would basically mean that I would live in one state and my son, my white son, would have to live in another state. You know, for me, when we talk about like my blackness and me saying that I'm an African-American man, it's true. I am proud of my blackness, but I'm not advocating for ethnostate. So I want to respect you as a white man. I see that. I understand that history. I want you to respect me as a black man and see that and understand that history and then figure how we move forward together. That's the difference between me and you, is that I want to move forward together and you feel like those fissures that are between us are too big to pass over.
I do respect your identity and I respect you as a black man. But the question I would have to ask is, do you really think that we're all better together? Do you think that modern America, contemporary America, there's greater levels of trust and togetherness than we had decades ago, or that other, you know, more ethnically homogenous nations have? I don't think so. And I have to be honest, I think we actually kind of hate each other. And that is a very tragic thing, and that's a very sad thing. And we don't trust each other. And we can talk about how one day we're going to all be holding hands, or we can actually be realistic about this. And we can actually look at the power of human nature and the power of race.
If that is your worldview, then I'm sorry. Because like I said, like I have white family members that I love. So no, I don't think that we hate each other. I think that there's not a nation in this world that doesn't have problems. But I would say that, like, when you just said, like, if we could go back X amount of years, would we be better? No, because I wouldn't be talking to you right now. We wouldn't. I wouldn't be in the position that I am in right now. And I'm sorry, but like, the mixing pot is already created. You're talking about going into a stew that's already been made, spilling it out and picking out each individual ingredient and thinking that you're going to have a whole thing that works again. And you won't.
I think you're using your own personal experience, and I think you're being genuine in talking about it, but you're projecting that onto everyone else's experience. Look what just happened. I mean, is this an example of how class trumps race? Is this an example of us getting together? No, it wasn't. Look, I can get along with non-white people. I do. There are certainly exceptions that prove the rule, but the rule is the most important thing. And that is that when you have two really dramatically different cultures, two dramatically different races all being forced together, it's a recipe for turmoil and distrust and hatred. And I don't know of an historical example that contradicts that.
Listen, you and I could like go back and forth nonstop. And if you ever want to have a conversation, like just to hear the other side or anything, you feel free to call me up because I will talk to you all day. Because I think, honestly, the only way forward is through. And the way through is that like people like you and I like actually have conversations. As much as I think that you're dead wrong and as much as you think that I'm dead wrong, we're actually, the fact that we're having the conversation is probably the best benefit that could come out of both sides of it. So, Richard, I appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us. And, yeah, like I said, man, seriously, if you want to have another conversation, I don't know how many black people you get to talk to in your life, but if you'd like to have a conversation at any time, feel free to give me a call. And if you'd like to talk to my son, I would love to put you on the phone with him to hear his experience of America.
Interesting. Let's do it.
See, every single thing that we are concerned about, every single thing when you turn on the TV tomorrow morning that they will talk about, will all be related to racism, white supremacy as a system. Okay, Donald Trump. I say meet your next president.
It's a movement comprised of Americans from all races, religions, backgrounds, and beliefs who want and expect our government to serve the people, and serve the people it will. Working together, we will begin the urgent task of rebuilding our nation and renewing the American dream. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
Context of white supremacy.
Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, November 12th, 2016. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have observations, thoughts, views, questions, concerns. The number is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. A couple quick things, and then we will get to folks on the line. I'm sure there's lots of folks waiting to give their commentary. Historic week, historic presidential election here in the U.S. First thing I would like to say, we do have Cal's listener, Cal's supporter, investor, whose mother passed away this week. Just want to send our prayers and condolences to her family. I know the system of white supremacy, black people are suffering and incurring harm, losses all the time. We just try as best we can to maintain mental health and just replenish and move forward. But the losses are there. Again, condolences, prayers to the listener and her family. Take time to heal. Take time to heal. Context of white supremacy. Other things that I wanted to get to before we get to callers. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's prediction. I've talked about it. I think this is about the fourth or fifth time that we've been on the air since the Tuesday election. And I've stated, I've reminded people about her prediction more than a year ago. I would just encourage people, if you're out, you're talking to people and they want to talk about the election, if they're frustrated, I get the at least the sense that there are some black people who want to talk about this, the election, and if they're frustrated about it or if they just have, you know, an opinion about what happened, I would bring up Dr. Welsing. For people, if they're familiar with Dr. Welsing, even better. Did you hear her prediction that Donald Trump was going to win even before she passed away, that a year in advance she was saying this, that he was going to win, and she was saying this confidently? I just think that that's one of the most important parts of her legacy in an election where you had just throngs of people who have were totally incorrect, who came out, and I mean, that's kind of rare in my experience to have people come out in a public format, national television type thing and say, we were totally wrong. We didn't see this at all. We didn't understand how to just have that. That was almost the rule in terms of what people said and have been saying for the last year, even all the way through the primaries and what have you, to juxtapose that with the brilliance of third generation physician, general and child psychiatrist, author, counter-racist scientist, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. It cannot be understated. And again, I think because the system of white supremacy, black lives, black concepts, black intellect is not valued. I think that's one of the things that we can do to make sure to give anybody, all of the folks that were in the group of saying that they thought Trump was going to win, those folks, it should at least be, well, let's hear what they had to say, because it seems that most folks had no idea how this was going to come, or at least they've lied about their understanding of all of this. Seeing as I think context of white supremacy would qualify as one of the few outlets where people were saying we thought, based on our understanding of white supremacy, that Trump was going to indeed triumph, I would hope, at least I got the impression people directly saying that this program helped them have a better understanding of the election, what might happen, and being prepared for those results, even making a few coins off of the results. I would hope that, you know, hey, for people who listen to this program, if it does help you get a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, and things that are going to happen in the world, things that are happening, and why those things happen, grand. That's the whole purpose of the program. This is not just for entertainment at all. And this is not just to get on the air and moan and wail and cry about our pitiful position. This is about understanding what is happening in the world. And I think if you get a better understanding, you can be better able to operate, to do things, and to solve our problems, ultimately solve the problem, white supremacy, racism. So just to get that in, even people reminded me back in May, we had Dr. Tommy Curry on. He's been a guest even since then. But back in May, and we talked about the election, he predicted also way back then that Donald Trump was going to win. He laid out his reasons as to why. Just I hope the cows has proven to be a constructive resource. And if that is the case, invest. If you think the program is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not in the PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. You can also invest on our Amazon wish list. Someone told me that it was not functioning. I guess they attempted to access the Amazon wish list this week. It didn't work. I tried it and it worked for me. If you go to Amazon, the wish list is under Gus T. Renegade. So if you put it in, it should pop up. If you have problems accessing it, let me know. But I tried it today just before the program and it worked for me. I will say that I am pleased that Clinton was defeated in the election. I mean, it would have just been, you know, a suspected race soldier in the White House either way. But I particularly did not want Hillary Clinton to be victorious. And I understand all the or at least the attempted counter racists like myself, the people who thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win. I understand the logic that some of those folks presented. I would have been nauseated, as bad as some black people allege to be feeling right now because of the election and being down about Trump. Man, I would have been in that category if Hillary Clinton had won. I cannot fathom and don't think I would have been able to easily stomach a week of black people and a whole lot of racists, like arm in arm, hand in hand, tears streaming down their faces as though they triumphed over bigotry and racism and kept a racist out of the like. Can you imagine the type of scene that we would be having if Hillary Clinton had won and that type of thing playing out across the nation? Like, man, I was not looking forward to that. I understand. That's why I said I understand the folks who thought Hillary Clinton was going to be victorious for that exact reason. Let's see. Someone, I think, asked on the program last week about talking about racism, white supremacy with your children, and specifically about how you explain to younger people that it's not just white men, that white women practice racism, white supremacy. In my view, they're equal partners. This election, I think, gave you phenomenal evidence, real-life demonstration. There are so many articles. It was not just the cows. There are so many articles and reports, mainstream outlets, where in big, bold-faced letters, that is it, the title exactly, talking about white women, the majority of white women voting for Donald Trump. You heard it in the audio clip. It was in the New York Times, and putting their racial interest ahead of their gender interests. That's how a lot of people have interpreted it. I just view it as white women, again, showing their allegiance to the system of white supremacy. But that is one right there. You have tons of resources. I posted a lot of articles that brought up that very subject, that very theme. I might even write one myself, even though I would almost say there's no need for Gus T to write on this topic because there's a plethora of material out there already. But at any rate, the cannabis legalization Maine was not included. I think the audio clip from Democracy Now, where Amy Goodman, my BFF, where she had talked about the states that legalized recreational cannabis, it was California, Maine, Massachusetts, Arizona. No, Arizona did not. Sorry. Massachusetts, Maine, California, and Nevada. Those were the four states. Maine was a little, it was very close. And so they were not included. So that was another state to include on the list. Big moment this week for cannabis legalization. With that, I think I will stop. One thing that I did think was important when they were talking about the South Carolina clip, race soldier Dylan Storm Roof, his federal trial coming up. They said, and that's such a huge lie, that NPR report, they said that, talking about the family members of the victims, they said they all talked about forgiving him, talking about Dylann Roof. That's a direct quote. That is a lie. And we played on the program this summer where some of the victims, family members of victims and some of the folks that were killed at the church, they said explicitly in no uncertain terms, they did not forgive Dylann Roof, could not and would not forgive Dylann Roof. And it was more than one. And I thought that was so important. This was during the anniversary back during June, during the 1 year anniversary, because you don't hear that. They just make sure to keep an endless loop of one black person who's still a victim of racism. She has VGQ saying, I forgive you and all that. But there were other black people who did not take that stance and they got VGQ too as well. But they don't want to promote that. They just want the image of us turning the other cheek and you can commit any act of barbarism and savagery against us and we'll just turn the other cheek and look for a hug and a photo op with Hillary Clinton. That is nonsense and it's not even based in reality. Now, folks who wanted to participate, the number again is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If we could not use metaphors, I have a ton of illustrations from this week of metaphors. They have just been willy-nilly all over the place and further evidencing why I say they should not be used or should at least be closely monitored when we're talking about racism. David Axelrod, I think he was one of the suspected racists who was involved with President Obama's election campaign. He was on Bill Maher last night where they were hand-wringing and gnashing teeth about the election. But after he said that Donald Trump was not racist, the metaphor he employed was that Trump winning the election was like a moral 9/11. And the crowd went wild. They just applauded. Yeah, right. And then he said this after he said that Donald Trump was not a racist. But I have no idea what that means. I have no idea how those two events are equivalent or related. If I was interpreting it, if Mr. Axelrod, if he meant that in these two events, whites told a lot of lies that were widely believed, I would say yes, then they are equivalent. But if that's not what he meant, I have no idea how those two events are related. And that sort of thing is done frequently when people are talking about white supremacy racism. So for this specific program, if we could not use metaphors, thank you kindly. People do exactly what Mr. Axelrod did, compare things that are not accurate or they do not provide clarity. I think whites do this a lot to practice deception. I think victims, unfortunately, a lot of times just in our confusion and trying to articulate our ideas, we use analogies or make comparisons that are not accurate. If we could just be direct, explicit, make it plain. Thank you kindly. If you could just take about 5 minutes to share whatever commentary or observations you have. Suspect there could be a lot of folks who have commentary about what took place. That's great. We'll try and make sure we get everybody. So if you could just take 5 minutes to share your commentary and then make sure you also use your mute button so we don't have a lot of unnecessary background noise. Thank you kindly. The first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. After hearing Dr. Welsing back on that COWS program, also I agreed with her soon afterwards that Donald Trump would be the next president in this part of the world. Based on how she explained it and also through my own research of focusing not on other non-white black people or non-white people, but focusing on white people and their pathology. It became more and more clearer to me that he was going to be the president. And I made a practice of ignoring anything that was not as clear based on white people's pathology. And so that's my take on on that. Also, the recent election reminded me of ancestor Dr. Khalid Muhammad, his speech, "The white woman is a bitch, a two-legged dog." And he, in that speech, he said, "Most of you say, when I say that the white man is the devil, you say, oh yeah, I know that old skunk is the devil. But when I say that the white woman is the devil too, you say, oh, wait a minute now. You mean the white woman is the devil too?" And he goes on to say, "The white woman is the mother of this beast." Basically, the white female was featured, apparently, in this election on how coy she is. And as you research white females, white women, this is a historical analysis of them and how they operate. Number two, black males and black females who think that white females do not qualify to be untrustworthy, I challenge you to research the voting pattern in the presidential election. And added on to that, the last thing I'm going to say is apparently, according to the evidence, the white collective denounced Mr. Trump publicly, but privately supported the most potent version of white supremacy. And this is not, and what has been suggested, and I think it holds correct, is that when you are attempting to practice counter-racism, you have to adjust your research and study and dedication to the level to whereas you can predict white supremacy. And I encourage and challenge all of us to work very hard personally in our focus and our concentration to be able to accomplish this as soon as possible so we can come up with an answer to this problem. Thank you.
Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, lines should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, folks. Thank you for saying what you said about Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, because I don't know how many times I've said her name since Tuesday, every chance I get, for many reasons, one also being because she is a third generation physician and a general and child psychologist and very intelligent, very insightful, very classy, very professional, very much like a master teacher, masterful in the way of teaching, and genuine about her desire for non-white people to truly understand racism, white supremacy. So sometimes I find that non-white people don't want to listen to, say, myself. I'm nobody. But I'll just keep saying her name, and maybe they'll go and Google her and listen to the cows or listen to something on YouTube, listen to her, and that can help them. So I've said her name so many times, I couldn't even keep count. But with that also, and kudos to you for, not even like it's necessary to give kudos, but I commend the work, I respect the work, I value the work, and I've gotten so much from it. So thank you so much to all the people who've made the cows be what it is. The only clip that I really had anything, the last clip or the second to last clip with the non-white black male and the white male, he said so many things. It was just, I was geeking. I'm not even going to lie. I was geeking over here writing notes. Because I'll just start, I took a few quotes. He said, well, are we a nation? And I thought that was like fantastic. Like, of course, that was like earlier in the clip, but that is exactly what Trump spoke to. That is what white people are talking about. That is what the book is about, The Rising Tide. Okay, anyway. And then which people actually define what America is. And he said whites are essential in defining America. And then he said that whites are indispensable. If whites are indispensable, then it means all non-whites are dispensable. And therefore, that's the conversation that's being had when there are no white people or no non-white people in the room. How do we get rid of these non-white people to create the ethnostate, which is something I had never even heard of? Well, I mean, I know about Israel for the Jews, but thinking that they wanted to create an ethnostate like this, he threw the term around as if it was just colloquial. It was like, this is just normal. We're always talking about creating the ethnostate. And then he mentioned the moral white guilt complex, whatever. And then, not to brush that off, because they do know what they've done, and they do know, if they're at all as intelligent as we give them credit for, that, you know, karma is real. And for every action, there is a reaction. And their intention is to make sure that that reaction never can happen by performing or acting genocide on all non-white people, because we are obviously dispensable. And then, so to call it moral doesn't mean that they will do the right thing. It just means that it's on their conscience. That's what I think when he said the word moral. And then he said, yeah, well, I was born in like 78. And so all I've seen is less whites in positions of power. And he said, which way is the arrow pointing? Like, what was fascinating about the way he carried the conversation was that a lot of times non-white people always want to talk and say, well, why can't pretty much we just get along? We're all people, we're all humans, like, why can't we not? And the thing that non-white people just do not get, and it is to our detriment, is that they pick the game. They're telling us what it is. If we all just wanted to get along, we would just all get along. That would be, that. There's nothing wrong with that. But if I keep saying, let's just get along, and you keep saying, no, I'm about to come and whoop you behind, then that's the reality. That's the ultimate reality. And I thought that was fascinating, because he said, which way is the arrow pointing? In my mind, I was like, I didn't even know there was an arrow. Like, I didn't look at this in terms of there being an arrow. But for them, there's clearly an arrow. There is a direction that this is going. And he even said, I may not be alive to participate. And this is not a quote. I may not be alive to participate in the battle to secure my white nation's future, but I know it's going to happen. So they already know that war is inevitable. Like, to me, that's what that meant. I'm not trying to incite anything in the call, but to me, that's pretty much what he said. We are already prepared to war against all non-white people. Doesn't matter if you're good or not good, or you got a white wife, or, you know, mulatto kids, or whatever it is. We don't care. We want the ethnostate. We identify as white, even though we may not describe ourselves off top that way. But that is what it is. And he said, pretty much if nothing happens, whites will be a minority. Again, that's why they put him in office. Trump spoke to their fears. They know that they're losing power. And then he said, are we really better together? Which I respected, because no, I was like, no, we're not better together. Ever since, for me, the white person, am I talking too long? I'll chime in later. Thank you.
Wonderful. Grand. All the folks who have commentary that we have not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Hi, Karma.
Hi, Gus. Hi, everyone. I didn't know if the audio was clear enough. Well, my thing for the last 2 years and 5 months is to figure out how local government works and see if I can influence it. So today was really my first election that was a real election. And I thought that Hillary might win until the voting started. And once the voting started, I realized that there was no way in heaven she was going to win. First off, in our son downtown in this rural area, we couldn't get anyone to work the polls from the Democratic Party. So I had to go work the polls in the Sun downtown. That was like, wow. Democrats, minorities, everyone's just freaked out. Secondly, the Muslim people around here started, one guy changed the name of his restaurant to Trump Restaurant. I'm like, you're the first person he's going to deport. And then while I was working the polls, I noticed that all of the Latino people were coming in, were voting for Trump. Second thing I saw was that they were lined up in the morning. I mean, we don't have any people. It's very rural, but they were lined up outside 45 minutes early to vote for Trump. And I knew they voted for Trump because after they left the polls, they all went and took pictures in front of the Trump signs. All day long, they were standing around taking pictures in front of the Trump signs. And it was amazing to me because it was like every single white person who's never voted in their lives practically showed up to vote for Trump. White people were coming in with not just on crutches, but on two crutches. People were coming in who were clearly in the middle of chemotherapy. I mean, people were coming in on with, you know, nursing assistance and not just one aide, but they needed two aides to carry them to the polls to vote. I mean, people were coming in on oxygen. They came in on everything except a gurney. White people came in literally who already had one foot on the grave. And I remember that Trump said, if you're dying, go vote for me first and then go and die. And that's exactly what they did. I've never seen so many white people vote in my life. They were just coming from everywhere. So the minute they started voting, I knew that it. And then plus, there were white people who were like 50 years old, and they said, could you help me? I've never voted before. And I was like astounded. I mean, the first 10 minutes of voting, I knew that Trump was going to win. And even with that, I'm starting to figure out just how corrupt this particular part of the world is. You know, the DOJ came down. They said, okay, well, this is a little place. You know, it's no big deal. It's a very tiny place with just a couple of people. But it seems to be the most corrupt place on the planet. So the DOJ came down, and they were really cute because, you know, they came into, they say, we're watching these elections. But then they came undercover. But everyone is pretty much related by marriage or blood, so everybody knew who the undercover DOJ people were. But you know, they said it was clearly things were going on to disenfranchise voters. But they always come down and they never do anything. So I wasn't expecting them to do anything, and they'll all probably be fired after Donald Trump is sworn in anyway. I've only done a little bit of voting analysis, but at the one poll I worked, 30% of the votes that I took in that I saw with my own two eyes were missing from the count. So that was very interesting. And then this lets me know. I really think that maybe this election really was fixed for Trump. Because even though all of the reporters kept saying, Hillary, 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 Donald Trump got more publicity than anyone else. And everyone knows that there's no such thing as bad publicity. You just need publicity. And he clearly just ran the race with the publicity. And plus, he just opened a Trump hotel six blocks from the White House. I mean, there's no such thing as coincidence. So this is probably fixed from the beginning. Let's see, the last thing.
Actually,
I want to say a quick.
If you could,
it's too late.
If you could hang tight and.
Okay. All right.
I'll come back to you for sure. I did want to make sure I got in there. The evidence has been reported, which her observation about having never seen this many white people vote for a candidate. The statistics have borne that out. That Trump got historic percentages of white people to come out and vote for him, that it was unseen in history for whites to galvanize like this around one singular candidate. Anybody else that we have not heard from? Other callers?
Heard.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I was watching the news that day, and I was astounded when they were showing Pennsylvania and the people voting, and they showed the line. It went around the corner, around the block about three or four times. And then I see the traffic going slow, and I saw a whole quartet of Amish people going to vote. And I said, oh, man, they pulled out the Amish. Like, they don't even have television, so that should just let you know that all white people voted. And I think all these marches in the street, half of those white people voted for Trump, too. And on top of that, they're just doing this because, you know, this is their practice of deception. They're going to walk around and act like he's a racist and they're against him. But that's only because they know that he got so many of the white votes. They got to show face. They got to keep this practice of deception up to keep us thinking that there's still some good white people. But it's impossible for all these white people to be marching around the streets for a huge percentage of them not to have voted for them. I think they're just practicing deception, just like all those who came on before saying they weren't going to vote for him. And he wins by this tremendous amount of the white vote. A lot of those people were lying, too. So I just think that's a big point. I don't think this was fixed. I don't think this was the results that the most powerful white people wanted. I think they weighed their option of afterwards, do we want the protest from Trump supporters or do we want the protest from Hillary supporters? And I think that was a pretty easy thing, because if they had Trump had lost, man, these protests right here, man, there'll be black people being lynched. I mean, it'll be complete insanity. I have a story I'll share later. I just want to, that's why I'm not leaving my name. Just wanted to leave the notion that I started a job and I took seminars, orientation, and one of the huge things was about compassion. And this tape had white people being wheelchaired into the hospital and how everyone just looked at them with such empathy and everyone was going out their way to help them. So keep that in mind, as that's the pretext to the story I'm going to share later. Thank you, guys.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Oh, greetings to you, Des, Thomas in New York, and all the other callers and listeners as well. This is a very interesting. I was going to say, in regards to karma, and peace to you as well, when she spoke about the Latinos coming out to vote for Donald Trump. I've said this for a number of years now, but essentially what I've noticed is white supremacists have been pandering to Latinos very intensely, and that is, I believe, because they're trying to also make them the next set of honorary white people, and basically so that they can gain some sort of control over their voting patterns, since they know that they're going to quickly take over as the most populous or the highest populated group, ethnic group in the country. So I think they're just preemptively shifting in that direction to try and get them to align themselves with white supremacy. I've even noticed on a lot of different, I guess you could say, like surveys where they'll ask you about your race classification, I'm noticing now that they have an area for white Hispanic and non-white Hispanic, which was something I've never seen until recent years. So all of this to me is just signs that they're moving in the direction of potentially making them the next set of honorary whites so that they can gain control over the way the system plays out moving down in the future. Also, when Karma talked about them choosing these candidates having been chosen early, I agree. Just about two mornings ago, I was listening to the news, and they had a letter that Donald Trump received from President Richard Nixon. This was back in 1986. They said he had just finished, just finished appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show, and they read the letter on TV, and they said that the letter said, "Don, you know my wife is a political expert. And she said to me that whenever you choose to run for president, that you'll win. And I agree with her." That's what the letter said. And this is 1986. So you're talking 30 years ago to the year. So definitely Donald Trump was going to become president a very long time ago. I don't think Richard Nixon would have written something like that to him without having that understanding that this was something that was going to be made a reality at some point down the road. I saw an article earlier today talking about red squirrels in Britain carrying a medieval human strain of leprosy, and it just made me think that medieval white people were raping squirrels. That's the only way they would have a human strain of a disease like that, no different than from white people raping farm animals and dogs and other animals. That's how the human species contracted gonorrhea and syphilis. That's also an intraspecies disease that we acquired from them raping non-white people, but originally raping animals first. And lastly, Yes, lastly, I just wanted to speak about a documentary I saw on National Geographic Channel and On Demand earlier today about Nat Turner, and it was fascinating. They had, I think his name is Richard Guinevere. He's the guy who played Smiley in Do the Right Thing. He was like the host of the program. They interviewed one of Nat Turner's descendants. They also interviewed a historian who found out that some of the people who were lynched along with Nat Turner were buried in a specific area in Virginia, Southampton, Virginia, and that they actually had a highway paved over the gravesite. And she had done a preliminary survey by digging up a number of holes in this area next to the gravesite where historically people have said that these bones were. And she actually did find human bones in this area. So they're looking now to see about potentially turning that place, because they actually built a highway straight over the gravesite and over the area to see if they can actually make that place a site that they where they commemorate the events of Nat Turner's insurrection. So it's a very, very interesting documentary. The one thing I didn't like is that they didn't use the term white supremacy. I wish they did, but it's still a very good documentary nonetheless. Thank you. Now I'll mute my line.
Check for that. Appreciate that, Roz. Other folks that we haven't heard from, feel free to chime in. I do request that people not use the term honorary white on the program. Just in my view, it promotes confusion. Is honorary white white? I'm asking these rhetorically because I've brought this up a few times over the years. Is honorary white white? Same thing. What's the difference between white and honorary white? These are questions that I would ask just, but I think in general it promotes confusion about racial classifications. Either you're white or you're not. Other
Thanks
folks,
for that insight.
For sure. It's in Mr. Fuller's Word Guide. He has a whole page on the term honorary white and discouraging use of that term. Did other folks who have we have not heard from have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I was just going to say, welcome to Nazi Germany. And also, I was just going to say also, I think we should be very focused on knocking down the numbers and eradicating the ICE albinos or the white people. We should be very focused on eradicating them in a war. That's your focus. You're supposed to take out the other, the opposition. So I would just say, what can we do to finish this? Do it in a year, and that's my only comments. Thank you.
How are we going to do that?
I did hear your question, Thomas, in New York. Once we get everybody to get their turn in, we have a question on the table about that. Other folks that we have not heard from, did you all have commentary, observations, questions you wanted to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace to Gus, peace to everybody on the line tonight. I am still getting over the fact that I am now going to be saying President Trump in about 2 months now, but life goes on, and there's a fallout, actually. Oh, pardon me, that's a metaphor. The result of his election has been on high display in the area and community in which I live. I was talking with my brother and sister earlier today, and where I grew up, which is about 45 minutes from where I lived, my brother went into an establishment to have a drink. I know about being sober, but he doesn't listen. And upon walking into the place, somebody at the bar said, monkeys stink. And then he sat down to get a drink. And a woman who was the bartender who knew him, knew my family actually, refused to serve him. And this woman is in her mid-20s and treated him rather rudely. And my brother was, he couldn't understand, while he could understand, he said that she did it because her white friends were around. And I quickly argued with him and argued that point away because as I asked him, she knows you, why would she then act this way? And he had to admit that, yes, there's a problem there. But outside of that, people have been, the glares, the glances, the looks, the smirks, all of it has been on just amazing display. And I'm not angry. I actually think this is great. And whether it was Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, this was going to come out. And this is just absolutely wonderful to me. Because now, people who have never, who told me, I remember vividly, people telling me, you're crazy, you know, asking me if I was racist, these black people, you know, why do I hate white people? And I always tell them, it's not about hating white people, it's about making observations. Keen observations about what's going on and following through with a series of actions to mitigate the effect those actions are having on you. And now they are starting to listen. So if that's what it took for them to actually open their eyes, I'm very, very happy. Gus, amazing, amazing program, amazing work. I completely... Your show in particular has been vital in the last year and a half to that awakening and my eyes coming open. I definitely give all praises to the ancestors for Dr. Welsing, who, wow, she called it. So thank you very much. And after the first of the year, I will be becoming a regular contributor once my finances stabilize. So thank you, and enjoy your evening.
Hello, good evening.
Greetings.
Hello. Hi, good evening. Thank you so much for taking my call. Hopefully everyone's having the best night they can have under the conditions of white supremacy. Again, thank you for the show, just in general. Thank you for Dr. Frank for, I guess, well, introducing me to her. I've never heard of her till the last 7 months of her life, so... Well, she was amazing, phenomenal. Thank you for the last interview between the white man and the non-white gentleman. I thought he was very honest. And if you're going to have these quote-unquote conversations that they keep talking about, that's one of the best ones to have. Look, we don't like... I mean, he should just say, we don't like you, and we don't want to be around you because I'm not that fond of you either. I would have said to him, I guess. I did notice that when the non-white man was talking about his children, how he had adopted one, the white one was the apple of his eye, and yeah, I got some others. That's kind of how he said it. Like, oh, this white child is the apple of my eye, and I have these others. So, you know, I guess VGQ, those are his kids. But so I guess, I don't know if he was just trying to impress on him that, oh, we love everyone. I don't know exactly what that was about. But yes, I am ready for the racism to advance. I had one situation last week before the election. This white lady, she wanted me to put her cart back because she was leaving and I was going towards the supermarket. She said, well, do you mind? I told her I kind of would. And I guess, you know, she didn't want to hear that. So she was like, oh, God bless you. You're going to need it. I was like, whatever. And I just kept on going to do what I needed to do. So I expect little incidences like that to arise. Fortunately, haven't had to have conversations where I work. I work at a school. I did ask the children kind of what they thought about it. Well, I shouldn't say children. I work at a college. These are grown, like purge type, I guess, that age. Not that they're purgers, but, you know, that age from the movie. One was really sad. One, he was happy. And I just let it go with that. Thank you.
Fascinating.
The observations about the I'm just gonna mute just so I don't have the background noise. The observations about the school and jobs certainly are welcome from all of our callers and what have you, in terms of just anything that you've seen on the job, or I guess if school, if that's what it is, if you experienced anything there, that's certainly welcome from any of our listeners as well, if you have additional commentary. Other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, observations, questions, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to everybody on the call. The Richard Spencer interview, the last one, it was definitely, as far as the, you know, what we talk about on this show, is definitely on point. The Richard Spencer was unapologetically white. He didn't make no qualms about it. And it shows that the non-white man, the black man that was, I guess he was a black man on the show, how confused he was in regards to why he thought that way. I mean, basically he just kind of spilled out the beans on white nationalism and, you know, and I don't know why the black man didn't understand why he felt that way. So it's a perfect example of the system of white supremacy and how it has confused us, and how, like I said, he made no qualms about who he is and what he wants and what's going on. Also, too, I want to share a quick experience I had today. Gus, if you ever come to Chicago, there's a library and collection called the Stony Island Arts Bank. It holds the former Ebony Jet library collection, which is massive. But there's also a collection, the Edward Williams collection, that he collects racist memorabilia in terms of articles, newspaper clippings, dolls and pieces that, you know, that basically are, you know, racist items. So I think you'll get a kick out of that. But today I was in the library of that, and I picked up the book, The Upcoming Race War in America by Karl Rowan. I never saw the book, so I'm just reading it. And what's fascinating is that Stony Island Arts Bank is in Grand Crossing neighborhood. It's one of the most violent neighborhoods in Chicago. And there are a bunch of white people that come there all the time. So today, two white men and a white woman were perusing in the library, and I'm sitting there reading the book. So when, you know, they were like fascinated on how many books are in here, you know, about African and African American history. So they come up to me and they ask me, "Excuse me, what book are you reading?" And I told them, "Well, The Up and Coming Race War by Karl Rowan." So the guy tells me, well, he asked me, "You don't have a gun, do you?" So, at first I was just going to say, yeah, it's in my pocket. But, you know, I just told him no comment and, you know, kind of just kept reading. So, but that was my experience today. I just wanted to share that with you guys. I'll go ahead and mute my line.
See how nosy? These were just strangers, and they came up and, you know, the audacity to come up and ask you what you're reading in a public library. That's what happened, right?
Yes, it did.
Right. The nosiness, that's what I mean about whites. They're not ignorant about racism, and in particular, they are paying attention to what their niggers are doing, reading. Like, they're supposed to be ignorant. He's supposed to be, you know, outside cutting a jig or doing a step or, you know, doing some, selling some CDs out of his trunk. He's not supposed to be in here reading. And certainly some Karl Rowan book about the coming race war in America, he's not supposed to be reading that at all. Incidentally, that's why I've said consistently, like, if you're on a job, book jacket, because whites are nosy like that. Just, you know, make an effort to not even inform them. And I would say out in public, feel free to ignore that you're not obligated to answer random white folks' questions, even or even tell them what you are reading. Just throwing that out as a suggestion. Other folks have commentary. Oh, and I did want to prompt about the metaphors. welcome to Germany, and we had to spill the beans. That's a metaphor as well. If we could just be mindful, myself as well, just being direct. No metaphors on the program for today, please. Thank you kindly. Other folks that we haven't heard from, did you all have commentary?
Hey, I could be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how are you everybody doing? I had a question for you too, girl, kind of in relation to what the other brother was saying, right? And I've been going through the archive, right? And I noticed how you very sharp on, you know, how when people, they be like, it's a machine. I know one lady said it was like a machine, you know, or the systems and the fabrics and all of this. And you always say, you know how you will cut them off and you say, hold on, stop right there. You know, people operate machines. You know, these is the actions of people, right? So, well, I was wondering, you know, my question for you is, so when we say, you know, that we need to eliminate the system, terminate this system, right, is it accurate to say that we need to eliminate these people? And because the system is operated by the people. So, right there, Abraham, but I appreciate what you're doing, bro, and, you know, you're doing a good job. And I'm just trying to get online with everybody, you know, trying to find out what direction everything going. But, yeah, I just want to say I appreciate that, man, and I'm going to mute my line.
All right, going. Thank you for the question. Appreciate it. My view is, and there's not consensus, there are victims of racism who think justice can be established while individuals who classify themselves as white still exist. There are others who think that justice cannot be established while individuals who classify themselves as white exist. You have to make your own conclusion about that. Either way, I would say they would have to be neutralized so that regardless if these individuals do still exist on the planet, they have no ability at all to harm black people. And really, in my view, they should have no ability to control any aspect of any non-white person's existence because they've already shown they are dedicated to the cause of racism, white supremacy. So that would have to be what it is. If individuals who classify themselves as white still exist, it would have to be non-white people, black people in particular, would have to get things in a position where white people have no control, no influence at all about anything, any aspect of our lives. As I said, some people think that that's possible while they're still here. Others do not. You have to come to your own conclusion about that and how that influences what we should be doing. Hopefully that answered the question. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, questions, observations, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, good evening, good night to everyone. This is Jay from New York. Just wanted to call in real quickly. A lot going on this week, as you mentioned earlier, Gus. Thanks for all your work, as everyone's mentioned. One thing I did want to touch on, I found that there was so much confusion and misinformation throughout the week, and I think Pam mentioned it on the program that she was on, in reference to these exit poll numbers. One thing that stood out to me as inaccurate in one of the clips played earlier is that the woman mentioned of Latinos being a young group. When I looked up the census information, the census stated that Latinos have been tracked since 1970. So it just kind of sounded odd to me as she said that it was a young group, but if they've been tracked since 1970, they've been tracked for like the last 46 years. So that just kind of threw me off a little bit. I also agree that I think someone mentioned earlier that the Latinos are being positioned to be like the next white classification. I think also, or maybe possibly the new targeted minority group over the blacks, just my kind of VGQ thought on that. I feel that a lot of these stories that I'm seeing highlighted in the media in regards to all this fear and anxiety seems to be all part of the plan of racist man, racist woman, and racist child to kind of push this acceleration of a less refined terrorism that they're trying to push out there. But just kind of things that I'm seeing. And I have some other things, but I'll wait for some other callers to kind of get in, and I'll probably try and jump back in later. But thanks for the time.
Other folks we have not heard from? Anybody that we haven't heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Ken Steele, and I'm reporting live from Inglewood, California. So I recently heard this whole Trump thing is I am not surprised at these results at all. I am not surprised that it turns out that most of these people who identify themselves as white, I'm not surprised that the majority of them went for Donald Trump. I think that it is very, very interesting that a majority of white women of all groups, of all levels of education, of all income levels, they all went for Trump, a majority of them. I have to urge all non-white people to understand that if you see a group of 10 suspected white supremacists, understand that statistically speaking, 6 of them voted for Donald Trump. You know, I was having a conversation with some suspected white supremacists who claim that they voted for Hillary Clinton. And one of them said, oh, well, if the statistics say this, does that mean that all of us voted for Donald Trump? And then I said, no, it just means that statistically, at least half of you are lying right now. So I think that it would be very wise for non-white people to understand that if you see a person whom you suspect is classified as white or who openly identifies as white, suspect that they are a Donald Trump supporter, just off the jump. Even if they're saying to you that I support Hillary, even if they are wearing, there's this safety pin badge that they're propagating, even if they're doing that, suspect them even more. I think that amongst suspected white supremacists that I did not vote for Donald Trump is the new I voted for Barack Obama, which was just a continuation of the whole I marched with Dr. King line that they used to propagate. And then prior to that, suspected white supremacists used to say, I do business with blacks. And then prior to that, they used to say, I didn't own slaves. And then prior to that, they used to say, you know, I don't rape my slaves. So this is the same lie along the gradient of white supremacy that has continued over the arc of time. And I suspect that we, people who classify ourselves or we have who have been classified as black, I think that we also have been revealed to be the most important non-white voting bloc. I think that a number of us have basically withheld our vote, and I think that the statistics bear out. And I think that if the Democratic Party wants to, I guess, court our favor or earn our vote, they need to give us something to vote for. Giving us racist A and racist suspect B is no longer tolerable. And I think that the suspected white supremacist, or the open white supremacist, or the white nationalist, however he wants to identify himself, I think that he and voices like his need to be studied by those of us who are non-white, because I think in those voices you are hearing the unvarnished truth, or sorry, the plain-spoken truth of what it is that these people are up to. And I guess that is what I have to report for now. Thank you so much, Gus, for having this program. And I guess it's Trump time now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I just wanted to have share experience I had with my job with a white person. So to put everything in perspective, like right now I'm going through a training class, and it's literally 13 black people and one white I guess it's so-called Mexican person and one white person. And anyway, so like when the election was going on, like our trainer was given some of the results. He's an anti-sexual black male. So anyway, you know, he's for Hillary. So he was given the results, and he was sounding disappointed when this is like at 5 o'clock in 5 o'clock Pacific Standard Time, and he's giving them he's giving the results, and he's actually disappointed. So anyway, the next day, in the break room, like all the black people are giving their analysis, analysis of what happened. And so the white dude is just sitting there listening. And I noticed it, so I was like, hey, like I called his name and he ignored me. And I called his name again and he ignored me again. And then I called his name a third time. So then he says, I said, what do you think about it? And then basically he says, I know there's like a lot of controversy. And I mean, the only thing I'm thinking about is that Obama's going to leave. Like, man, I really liked him. He spoke so well. I actually worked on his campaign, and he interjects like, oh, and I was the only white guy there working on his campaign. And I really, really am disappointed that he's going to leave. Like he literally said he shed a tear. So, and then after that, he said that he was going to, he really hopes that he gets to see Obama speak after he leaves. So that was all I had.
What a hoot. I'm really hoping Michelle Obama writes her memoirs of her time in the White House and can reveal some truth. I'm sure she won't be able to say everything. They'll vet material, but I'm sure she, or I hope she's able to reveal a little bit about some of the things that happened that we did not see as it relates to racism, white supremacy. That's my hope. And I would suspect that even the guy that you just mentioned probably voted for Trump too. Certainly is a racist.
Yeah, exactly.
But probably voted for Trump
exactly.
too.
Go ahead. I was going to say, and what's funny, when we first went to the orientation of the class, somebody said, like a lot of the middle management at this company, it's like a lot of black people. But anyway, it was around some black people. He was like, somebody said, made a joke about Trump. Like a black lady made a joke about Trump. He's like, oh, I'm not with Trump. Like, so, you know, basically like nobody even looked at him to think he was with Trump. And he just blurted out like, oh, I'm not with Trump. So I'm sure he did vote for Trump.
Yeah, the lie fed that. That cannot be understated. This is one of those times where, in my opinion, that was a big part of the problem. You had a lot of white people lying before and after the election. And I just think a lot of non-white people, you're confused about racism. You're confused about what it means to be classified as white. It makes it very easy for them to dupe us. They don't have to do a whole lot. They can just shed a tear or go out like some of these hooligans and break a window, and I'm so upset about Trump, I've just got to smash a window. And that's what this is 21st century racism in all its different manifestations. Other folks that we have not heard from, did you have commentary?
May I be heard?
Ma'am, go ahead.
Hello, guys. Hello, callers. This is Miss Meds out in Portland, Oregon, having lots of action out here. But speaking of Michelle Obama, I just wanted to speak about how she made that comment in her speech about when they go low, we go high. And I immediately bust up, cracked up laughing when I heard that, because I don't know where these people have been living, but America isn't like that. They don't have morals. They don't have political correctness. America doesn't give a fuck, and they love it. So
G-rated,
and
G-rated,
Hillary.
G-rated.
Oh, okay, sorry. Hillary took that slogan or that statement and that strategy, and it was stupid. It was silly, and tried to create a PC campaign, a PC outrage campaign, and we all seen how that works. The next thing I wanted to speak about was how we were talking about how America is trying to make Hispanic people, I guess, the next chosen white people. Evidence that I have seen of that, I'm always looking online for jobs, regardless if I need them or not. Employers where I'm at are requiring that people speak Spanish. And I gather that they'd rather have light-skinned Spanish Hispanic people than have any other group of minorities working with them or next to them. My next observation, when I was watching the election, I noticed at least three different companies that make these doomsday preparation meals. They last for like 30 years. One had one that lasted for 25 years. Another one had a prep meal package you could buy that lasted for 20 years. So there's lots of variety out there. I think that that is a signal that white people are preparing for war, and we are inevitably going to be at war with someone, whether it be in America or overseas or whatever. And I'm also noticing or hearing that lots of people in the military voted for Trump. They love war. This is how they get paid. This is how they make their coins. And my last, this is a question, I guess, to ask other people. Maybe they've had similar situations. How do you plan to deal with or break bread with, say, other family members, codified or not, who you know have voted for Trump? And I don't know what I'm going to say to it. We have one person in particular, and I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say to them. And that's all. I'm mute my line.
My quick response to that, and then we can get the mail caller that just spoke up as well, but my quick response would be, if you things that do not have, that are like not pertinent to our discussion, like politics or whatever it is, where you know you all have a difference of opinion, I would say, you know, you don't have to talk about that. Certainly, I'm always about constructive things. I think that's one of the recommendations Mr. Fuller has about our use of time and energy. We're not exactly seeking people out to have a debate about how dumb they are for voting for Trump. We should be seeking out other non-white people. We have something constructive to do. So if we have a project we're going to be working on, or trying to make a new library, or whatever it is that's constructive, then we go talk to the family member, a friend, or whoever it is. Then we go talk it up. We talk about the project. When that's done, that might be it for our time. I'll catch you next week or whenever we're supposed to meet next about the project. Them voting for Trump, they got BGQ. No big deal. I wouldn't feel compelled to bring it up or remind them about it or argue about it or what have you. The election is done now. Moving forward, what problem are we trying to solve? That's the way that I would try to approach things. And if she brings it up, she just says whatever she says, and moving forward. Next topic. After she says you don't have to engage. You don't feel compelled to get into some sort of back and forth exchange or debate around it. She made her choice. You made your choice. Moving forward. If you can think of some questions you'd like to ask, that's great. If not, back to constructive projects. That would be my suggestion. the male caller who spoke up simultaneously with Ms. Mintz, did you have commentary?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Thank you, sir. Greetings to guests, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to make note about some terms that I heard on, that was Tuesday, and I'm down here in Florida, so I was looking at like how they kept analyzing the state, and it was using, two colors, red and blue, and they kept using this term called rural, R-U-R-A-L, I think that's how it's spelled, and it seemed like they was codifying that term, like it was using repetition, and I think it was meant to align with the white populace in those areas, and they kept pointing down to Miami-Dade County, and I guess that would be more non-white people down there, so the guy just kept saying, maybe, these votes are 64%, this still could factor in for some more votes for Hillary Clinton, and I turned off the TV and turned it back on, and it was already Florida was going to Donald Trump. And, later on in that week, I keep hearing the term angry voters. Somebody used that word at the job, angry voters. And it means to, I guess, make it seem like it's something to embrace. But black people are called this word when they are expressing their views on being mistreated. So it's like they, present that hypocrisy, and women, that word was being used too. But I think that they starting to distance themselves away from it because they know people are starting to point out that a lot of white females greatly supported Donald Trump in the election. And I think they don't want people to pick up on that because they still will use the women and minority term. And, I'm also seeing that in some of these reports that a lot of people are saying that they're shocked. And they even said fifth graders were chanting, build a wall. And there was a woman at my job that had, it was a customer. She had called up, and I was trying to help her with her records. And she started pretty much being very discourteous. So, I kept calm and stayed codified, and she was just saying, who did I vote for? And then I said, ma'am, this has nothing to do with what I'm trying to help you out with. And then she just started going on with it, trying to be a little persistent. But she ended up saying before she hung up, she said something very strange about you. And I'm going to figure out what it is. But I'm puzzled by the way you're speaking to me. I just can't seem to get through to you. So she hung up the phone, and I told my coworker what she was saying about asking about who was I voting for, and she said, "Well, she would have said that to me. I would have said, who am I voting for? Why don't you come help me build the wall?" So that was very powerful to me, and that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
Wow. See, I've said that consistently on the job. Now, this wasn't a coworker, but whatever. I've said this consistently on the job. Whites, they will do things deliberately to provoke you. That's all it's about. They're just trying to get you angry. That make they get a little bit of enjoyment for 5 minutes. Like, oh, I got on that nigger's nerves. And then they get to go on. And that's why I think it's so important in terms of managing our emotions on the job. And just understanding that when we're not surprised, we are not shocked. We understand what it means to be white and how they function. And we just go accordingly, like, oh, okay, right, I see. And just moving right forward, you already know how you're using your words. You're not going to be yelling and jumping up and down and that sort of thing because you're angry or stunned about a white person practicing racism. And it seemed like in her response, like that's what she was looking for. Like, man, what is the problem? I'm doing everything I normally do to get these niggers to chimp out, and he's not doing it. Man, you are a strange nigger. It seemed like that's pretty much what she said, right?
Yes, sir.
Without the
yes,
nigger.
Yes, sir. Basically.
being codified on the job, super, super important. That's why we do the workplace racism every Thursday, but extremely important. Just being a professional counter-racist soldier. That's what it's all about. That's the epitome. That sort of thing is going to happen. You understand that. You know what this environment is about. You don't respond to those things. You already have in mind what you're going to say, what you're going to do, how you respond given the situation. Other folks have commentary. Paying attention to those terms is important, too, all throughout this process. Other folks that we have heard, have not heard from, anybody that we have not heard from, have commentary?
And may I be heard?
Let's get 2812. 2812.
Hey, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers. Just two quick observations. First observation this week was, particularly on just social media and with all the articles coming out from all these different, just various sites from non-white people, the one thing that I've been noticing is the use of the word fear a lot, and the use of words such as what are we going to do, or terms like what are we going to do. I think that just adds to the confusion, because just based upon what I've seen and just using logic, non-white people, we are already scared of white people. So when people say things are going to get worse, I'm just kind of sitting there saying, well, based upon our behavior on our jobs and where we live and what we do and just how we interact with them every day, there's already a sense of fear. And I just think that when people can just try to just use those words properly and just observe their own behavior, I think it just becomes a little bit easier, because you'll just realize that we've already been intimidated, we're already at war, we're already in a system of white supremacy. So, you know, becoming more codified is going to be helpful. But I just see a lot of non-white people, just their emotions are up and down, when I think if they just step back, and I know it takes time, but just step back and say, you know, based upon my own behaviors, I've already been fearful. The second thing is that someone had said something on a Facebook post. It was a bunch of white people, and I typically don't respond, but a gentleman had made a comment to someone about, hey, we shouldn't be blaming white people for this whole election thing, and, you know, white people are always the first in line, and, you know, we don't blame Mexicans, and we don't blame blacks for this and that. And I said, well, let me just throw in my hat and just see what, you know, if this is going to be constructive or not. And I just responded to him, and I went codified, like I literally almost typed a sentence like Mr. Fuller would say to do it. As I said, the people in charge are the most to blame. Typically, those people are not white. I mean, are not non-white people. I said, I just could be wrong, but I doubt it. And this white gentleman actually responded, and he said, you know, I wouldn't use blame. I'd use responsible, but that is correct. And I said, very interesting. And he said, why do you think that's interesting? And I didn't even respond back to him. And my last thing, and I'll let everybody go. I know it might be kind of hard for difficult for people, but I highly suggest sometimes in your spare time, even if you're studying your code book or anything like that, go to Stormfront. It won't hurt you. And read some of the news articles that they have, and read some of the commentary. You can learn a lot just by some of the words that they use and how they codify themselves. And I know people might think that that's a white nationalist site, but those are just regular everyday white people that are your managers, your teachers, and things of that nature. And also, there are a lot. I mean, there's been an increase in white females on Stormfront as well. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate that. The caller at 5098, 5098. Did you have commentary?
May I be heard? Thank you. Another great show, Gus. Thank you. I'd like to piggyback on something the other callers about covering up your books. I was in a public market. And this last time I did it, and I just happened to have Professor Gerald Horns, the chair of the African American Studies, University of Houston. He has a book called The Counter Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. And on the front of his book, there is an enslaved African holding a saber with his hand around the throat, what appears to be a British or an American in the 1700s. And I was sitting there enjoying some food in a public market in a mall, and this white woman came out of nowhere and said, "I'm curious about what you read," and picked up the book and looked at the cover. Of course, there was silence, you know, to see this African about to slice this European. But so at that point, I don't bring out books with me or try to have them covered. But what the last caller said was important. There's a guy by the name of Jared Taylor. I don't know if you guys know who he is. He's in line with Richard Spencer. He is a white nationalist and founder and editor of American Renaissance. It's a white supremacist publication. And he has a book out called The Real American Dilemma, which is a play on Gunnar Myrdal's An American Dilemma. And in this book, he cites Blumenbach and the bell curve and the heads of conference and brain size related to intelligence. He even has a breakdown of mixed race kids are higher IQ than blacks and then whites and adopted families. It's basically pseudoscience, but I think it's a good read because you can understand how they think. And again, the storm front and so many others that the other last caller said, if they are studying us, and I think it behooves us to study them. And, you know, and again, I echo your sentiments, Gus. I am happy in a sense that Trump won because hopefully it'll wake some people up. And at the same time, I cannot get over the super predator and all the other things and all the shady stuff. I mean, if you want to look at it from a different perspective, the super delegates and what they did to Bernie, and I'm not no Bernie supporter either, but they basically, Donna Brazile and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and all of them basically stole that from him. With the delegate counts, especially California. So, but anyway, that's all I had, and I'm going to say great show, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
For sure. Just making sure I get in. I have concluded, just based on counter-racist logic, that Donna Brazile, there is no way she could have stolen anything from Bernie Sanders, since she is a black female and he is a white man. She does not have that much power to take anything. If she did or has been accused of any wrongdoing, at most, she could have been following orders from another white person suspected racist. That's what I would say on Donna Brazile, because I've seen a lot of folks attacking and blaming her and throwing her name about, which is just more of the tackiness of the system of white supremacy, in my opinion. Did we miss anyone? Anyone that we haven't heard from at all? Got everybody? We have less than 30 minutes left, so no folks coming in last minute with commentary. We didn't miss anyone. If you have a hand up, we got you. Phenomenal. I did want to make sure I said also the female caller, she spoke earlier when she was saying that in the reveal clip, Al Letson, he was talking to the quote-unquote white nationalist, where she said that he mentioned his adopted white child and that being the quote-unquote apple of his eye, another metaphor that he said, but she pointed out how significant that was. I agree. And I also thought in that same interview, I thought it was very important where he said he's talking to this suspected race soldier and he says, "I looked at your photograph. You're a good-looking guy. You're smart." He's making all of these laudatory comments, and it just struck me as strange, particularly to be commenting on, you know, "You're such an attractive guy," talking to this, you know, person who, I mean, he's not using the term racist, he said nationalist, but same thing in my opinion. And I'm, you know, you look so good, and why can't we just get along, and why can't it was just very, very strange to hear. Not that I'm unaccustomed to hearing non-white people speak in that manner, but if we're supposed to be having a serious conversation about racism, which is war, to have a non-white male commenting on the physical attractiveness of a white man? Wow. Did other folks have commentary, and has anyone seen black people being blamed for the election? Because I have seen some of that over the course of the week, black people being blamed somehow for not voting in the same numbers that they did for President Obama and a few other gripes that they've snuck in. But have people seen that also, black people being blamed for Trump's triumph?
I saw that a lot.
To be expected.
Before the election.
And blacks voted at a clip of 88% for Hillary Clinton. And I think in 2012, it was like 93% for Obama. So it wasn't that far off. Nobody else went out and voted for her at that high rate. Even the Latinos, it was like 73 or 75%, something like that. But, I mean, he was talking about building a wall and kicked them out. And they didn't come out at 88%. And she couldn't even thank us at that speech when she conceded. And I just think that was conceded. And wow, I'm glad she's not the president.
Hey, Gus, I think there was... I think Dr. Curry posted an article about black males specifically. I think the percentage, and somebody else might have saw this one, not from Dr. Curry, but I think the percentage of black males that voted was like from, it went from like 92 to 88%. And, you know, one of those sites was saying this was the reason and stuff like that. And even Dr. Curry, I think he pointed out on his Facebook page that even if all those black males had voted, it still wouldn't have made a difference. And that was one specifically. And a lot of people on social media blaming black males, saying you're the reason, and just black people in general, just really, really tacky, as if we are the reason that, you know, racism exists. So just typical.
Can I be heard?
I
just wanted to state that conceptually, most non-white people, especially non-white black people, do not understand that there is not anything functioning such as America, the United States. There's only one world government, and white people don't have to build another wall. They don't have to do anything else other than deceive us, or if we don't go for the deception, mistreat us by using direct violence. And that's all they have to do on a global basis and stay refined under the system of racism, white supremacy. And what confuses us, therefore what confuses us, is the whole idea of what white people identify as an electoral process. And most of us still, unfortunately, think that this is a possible means to solve this problem. And it's almost like someone who has constantly been beating you, and you and they have their particular plan, and you think that you can use their plan to solve your problem, solve the problem of getting defeated, and which is not logical at all. I was doing something, you know, some other work directly with football, preparing for a game. And in turn, when you do it as a coach, you know, you do a tendency. Tendency is what your opponent is doing. And from there, you can basically predict what your opponent is going to do at any given point in time. Now, you can transfer that logic right into what I'm talking about right now. White people have always been very consistent in what they say and do, with lying from the standpoint of being very good at being deceiving, and or if that that's one option. The other option, as Mr. Fuller said, direct violence. And if you stayed in that understanding, you will be either not confused or a lot less confused than what you were beforehand, and you would be focused on, you know, you can predict, like I said, you can predict what's going on with white people, and as a percentage of us be able to master this, then we can solve this problem. And those are my last thoughts today. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Were there any female callers that were trying to get a word in? Just making sure we didn't miss anybody. I thought one or two of y'all might have been speaking up. Any female callers had a word they wanted to get in?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
This is Miss Meds again. I was just saying that I did see how several news organizations and media were trying to set up that it would be the fault of black people and or minorities if Hillary Clinton didn't win. And that was particularly during the time, the week before the election, when Hillary was stomping around with Jay-Z and Beyonce. So they thought that that would be a good opportunity to bring that in. And another observation that I made, was the night of the eve of the election when Hillary Clinton landed in her hometown of New York, and there was a crowd actually showed up for her for once, not a crowd of supporters, not a crowd of donors, showed up, and she decided that she was so flippid that she didn't want to speak to them. And she didn't need to speak to them and decided to just get in her motorcade and go on her merry way. And the only person to blame for the election turning out the way that it did, and the only it is to blame is Hillary Clinton and her flippant attitude towards certain groups of people. And just running this ridiculous PC outrage campaign. And that's all I want to say.
Karma, were you going to finish up your commentary from earlier? Karma, are you still with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. This is going to sound somewhat disjointed, but we did figure out that the voter suppression was coming because the people in Section 8 housing were told that they were going to lose their housing if they went to vote. So that we did identify. Secondly, the students at the HBCU were not given adequate equipment, so they wound up standing in line for hours and missing classes and things. Yes, I want to give you a quick update on Ms. Sandra Bland, on her death. We did run a sheriff. We did run a local person against the sheriff here in the county, but he didn't win. He didn't win. But what I did notice is that the sheriff who was over the university that Ms. Bland was coming away from, that she had been hired, that sheriff just made history. She ran in another county, Beaumont County, one of the most racist counties, and she won. She's a black female sheriff, and she won. And, I mean, she was the sheriff who was there at Prairie View when Ms. Bland died, you know. So, and then also the sheriff who was there was transferred out. And I'm like, wow, that is astounding. But she was very, very, very quiet during the entire time when they were investigating Ms. Bland's death, when she actually had some jurisdiction. So the last thing I want to say is today I was standing outside and I saw this Chevy Tahoe being pulled over. It was three white women and a white man, and this Latino police officer was speaking to them, and then the woman got out and she took beer cans and she just put them in the dumpster. He let her put beer cans in the dumpster. And I watched in amazement. There was no breathalyzer. There was no walking the line. But he didn't even ask the gentleman in the Tahoe to get out or anything. And he ran their plates, and they went on about their merry way. And I went over to the dumpster while he was in his police vehicle, and I took pictures of all of those beer cans that they just dumped in the dumpster. And I was absolutely astounded. They got their ticket, or maybe it wasn't even a ticket. Maybe it was just a warning, and they're open beer bottles and stuff, and they just drove away. So I just wanted to share that with you guys, that the laws don't apply at all, not even a little. If they were black, they would have been sitting on the curb, hands cuffed behind their back, vehicle towed away. Nothing. It was nothing. So I wanted to share that too. Oh, I'll tell you next week. That's it.
I think that's Zena Stevens, the name of the black female sheriff in Texas.
Right, right. Zena Stevens, Chief Stevens. Former Chief Stevens.
I read an article about her where they were, in the same article where they were bragging about electing Ms. Stevens as sheriff, they also bragged about voting for Donald Trump down in that area, because of course he won Texas.
Have you heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm so sorry, Gus and audience. I forgot to put on star 6-1. I was waiting and waiting until I was unmuted, but then I'm looking here and I didn't put on star 6-1. I want to say greetings to you and the whole audience. I, for full disclosure, I did not think that Donald Trump was going to win when I had an opportunity to listen to Frances Presswell make that statement a year ago. I had an opportunity to actually talk to her on your show. I thought that, you know, at that point I said, this woman, I think that she's gone too far. I'm just being totally honest, I said, I think she's gone too far to think that this guy is gonna win the election. And here we are, November 2016, and he did. I'm just really, now I believe it's like reality just like slaps you in your face. You know how you say, Gus, people, we African-Americans are not really, what word do you use, that we really don't accept racism, or we really don't really want to accept there's that much white supremacy out here. And I guess maybe I want to accept it to a level, but I guess I am thoroughly convinced that this is really what it really, really is. And I see it. I the incident where the black guy was talking to the white guy, I said that this guy is so confused. This white guy is sitting here telling him, and I took it down here because it's like a flash went off in my mind. He said, don't you know that we really hate each other? Right here. He said that there are people who don't want to live together. And he just kept saying, oh, no, that can't be the way you feel. I know you really want to accept us. You just don't understand. You're not around us to really understand or accept us. That's the way you're really feeling. And he's telling him in his face, I don't like you. Although I'm, like you said, he said, oh, you look good. You're dressed really nice. You seem like he's just like a Klan guy he's just out there. He's out of the closet Klan guy. And this guy, this guy really, really opened my eyes tonight to show us that black people are confused and thinking that white people like us when they don't. After Trump won, I have not smiled at any white people at all. I refuse to. And the fact that the women, basically 53% of them, voted for him. And I said to myself, wow. And, you know, I know all black women who are in the audience today know that it has had trouble with white women on the job. I mean, if any person, it has been with white women on the job in terms of racism. So that's what I have to say. So I am so thankful that I'm here to be a witness today that I was that confused black person. But I'm not confused anymore. So I really, really, really appreciate your time and giving me this opportunity to speak. And I mute my line.
Appreciate it. Yes, sir. I just wanted to get in really quick. I appreciate the honesty. I think a lot of people have commented in that manner about Dr. Welsing. I think her understanding of white supremacy, again, I think it's so accurate. And then I think a lot of times she's talking about things that it might take other people a little while to grasp because they just don't have her understanding of white supremacy. But I think even when she made that prediction at her institute, and these presumably are students who've been there weekly, you know, some of them have been there for years, have been hearing her, people were laughing when she said then, in December of last year, that he was going to win. People at her institute were laughing, snickering, like, you know, oh, that's just bananas. There's no way he's going to win, and who's laughing now? Roz, was that you?
Yes, it was. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I was going to say, this made me think because I said before when everything first came to fruition as far as him, Donald Trump winning, I said some way they're going to find a way inexorably to blame black people for what's taking place. And if you think about it, if we only make up 13% of the population, if that's the truth, because white people lie so much, but if we make up such a number that is so low that we really wouldn't be able to make any significant sort of headway in regards to
us being in control of voting anyone of note into office, then where is this this whole ideology that black people are behind Hillary Clinton losing the election is coming from? But it just makes me think that the way the system of white supremacy works, black people get blamed for everything. We have no control over any aspect of our existence whatsoever. But yet when anything goes wrong, inexorably it comes back to, yep, it's the nigger's fault. And, you know, that's just the main theme of what I was thinking just throughout this whole process over the last week. And I've seen quite a bit of rhetoric where they're alluding to the fact that it's black people's fault that she lost, when in reality it's just her criminal behavior and her lack of ability to be in touch with what they call the Rust Belt white males, which are just dirt road white trash white males, whom Donald Trump was able to get through to in a way that no other presidential candidate was able to. And that's really the major force behind, I think, why he won. And that's just what it is. And for me, like you've always said too, like even when you have sometimes other attempts to counter racist, we'll start off discussing an issue that has to do with white supremacy, and somehow, you know, like I think you discussed the fact that it'll start going in the direction of white supremacy and somehow come back around to some other black person. And that's just this entire system is just, that's the way it's designed. Everything is a black people's fault, and that's just the way it's going to be in perpetuity. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to say earlier, if you took the black people who cannot vote because of the Clinton-Clinton bill, she probably would have won the election. But so many black people can't vote because of her husband's crime bill. It doesn't allow someone with a felony to vote. So just keep that in mind. And I wanted to say, like I said earlier, learned about compassion and empathy. So I got a call last night from my mother saying that my aunt was in the hospital. So I said, oh, really? So I, you know, go down to the ER. And, you know, all of the beds are separated by a curtain. You know, just like a curtain that separates you. So I'm looking for where, you know, she might be. And I find it. And she's curtained in between a person in handcuffs with six cops. They're loud walkie-talkies sitting around that area. And on the other side is four correctional officers with someone in handcuffs. I guess someone who got sick at the county jail. So I said, man, this is compassion when you're in an all-black area. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
That's funny. Wish your aunt the best.
Yeah, what's her mother? What's her mother?
Mother, sorry. Anybody that we missed or anybody have other commentary they wanted to make sure they get in before we wrap things up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'd also like to add on that I learned about the results of the election on Facebook, and I learned about it through status updates. And I told the person that I was around at the time. It was a white person. I told this person that Donald Trump had won, and he acted kind of in a state of disbelief, and he acted as though, you know, he didn't even know that there was an election that day. And, you know, he was saying, oh, wow, I can't believe it, yada, yada, yada. And as the conversation went on, he started talking about how Donald Trump is ushering a new era for where the elites will prosper. And I asked him if he was an elite person, and he responded yes. And this person, I know for a fact, is a felon at least twice over, and is not is not in a financially advantageous position, but nonetheless, he categorized himself as one of the elite. So these people are being, I don't know if the word is energized, but they are very, 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 feeling very high on themselves. They may not outwardly show it, or they may not outwardly say it. They may even pretend to find this abhorrent. My inbox is full of people who are classified as white swearing up and down that they did not participate in the election of Donald Trump. And I just want to end this my portion of this broadcast by saying, do not give these people the benefit of the doubt. If you see a person that is classified as a white person, assume, regardless of what they're telling you, that they voted for Donald Trump, just to be on the safe side of things. Anyway, I'm Ken Steele, and that's all I have for this week. You guys have a nice one. I'll mute my line.
We had a listener that wrote a question in. They said, we are now hearing the term white nationalist, even in mainstream media. However, what does a white nationalist do that is different from a white person? What is the definition of a white nationalist? Just curious. Those would be, as always, great questions to ask the person that uses the term white nationalist. What is the difference? If we get one on the program, that would be a great question to ask.
Hey, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Just to piggyback off of Ken Steele, I think that was a brilliant observation, and I'm glad he said it because it triggered a thought that I wanted to convey that I forgot about.
Which,
to me, what we're seeing is the biggest example of white rhetorical ethic. Just with all of the protesters burning things down, they hate Trump, they didn't vote for him. I agree with him 10,000%. This is the greatest example of rhetorical ethics on display to fool non-white people into thinking that there's a such thing as good white people. So this is something to be very, very wary of, because I can see over the coming months, especially up until the time that Donald Trump takes the official office, that we're going to see a lot more of this, to the point where we're going to see a lot more non-white people convinced that there is a such thing as good white people. So thank you so much, and I'll mute my line.
For sure. That will wrap us for the week. We did our 3 hours. We'll be here on Monday. The co-author of Dr. Tommy Curry's, it was a report that they did about racism that black students experienced on college campuses. He also, this is like a separate report, separate concept. He talks about the term racial battle fatigue, where you just get worn down. You have so many instances of racism to deal with, different court cases. Sam Dubose, the black male who was shot and killed on camera in Cincinnati. This was, I believe, last year. The trial for the officer who was charged in his death. They had a hung trial today, so he was not convicted, the white officer who killed Mr. Dubose. But you have so many of these incidents that it just, and I think he was a University of Cincinnati enforcement official, if I remember correctly, but you have so many of these incidents that it wears down, it erodes your black mental health. Dr. Wells spoke about that all the time, but this is a black professor. He's at the University of Utah. I am much more interested in talking to him now, in addition to all of the work that he's done and the report he co-authored with Dr. Curry. Him being in Utah, that was a state that whites had been saying, Trump's not going to win. The Mormons, they don't dig Donald Trump at all, and he doesn't go over out here. They're not going to vote for him. Utah's in play. Hillary Clinton can steal it from him. And none of that turned out to be true. Donald Trump won Utah, and they all sat around, oh, my God, I can't believe that. So we'll be looking forward to getting his thoughts, if he was surprised about that at all, since he's out there, he's around these good whites in the Utah area. Was he surprised about that, or did he think that was about what was going to take place? But that'll be Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, this coming Monday. And I think we might even be back in the middle of the week, just because I think I cannot overstate the importance of Dr. Welsing making that prediction. I really wished the report that I wrote on her, 12 pages with footnotes, the report that I wrote on her prediction about Donald Trump, I wish that it had already been published. Whenever it is, I'll make it available, because It wasn't just in that moment that she had been talking about predicting what ultimately took place this week. If you go back and you listen to some of her commentary and what she had been saying for years, you can hear the lead up to Donald Trump being elected and things Dr. Welsing had been saying, that she was seeing behavior patterns and talking about white genetic annihilation, birth dearth, or the browning of America, whatever terms are used, white people talking about their minority status on planet Earth and how that was motivating behavior and how much she was seeing that. It's really incredible. So I think we probably will be here in the week just to play some of the clips and things over the years so you can hear what she had been saying that led up to her making such a confident prediction a year in advance that Donald Trump was going to win. But you can just check Black Talk Radio Network or the Facebook page, and you'll see the date time for that later in the week. If you have questions, if you have problems, if you can't find something in the archives, if you have a guest suggestion, gripe, complaint, whatever the case, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. We will try to respond promptly. Sometimes the mail does get sent to spam or whatever else, so if you do not hear back and you've been patient, feel free to mail again, and I will be sure to get in touch with you. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I hope folks are staying constructive. I have contended for a minute that this election was a part of white saying we're kind of done with refinement. We want to go back to a more overt, explicit form of racism, white supremacy. Dr. Welsing, she called this the reconstruction of white supremacy. I would take that seriously. If you think that that's accurate, I would take that seriously, and I would make sure that your conduct, your behavior, reflects the seriousness of these times always. Sobriety would be best, where you spend your time and energy, the people that you're around, the situations that you put yourself into. Really make an effort to be alert, attentive, and just use counter-racist logic. And keeping in mind that we are already vulnerable as black people in a system of white supremacy, let's make sure that we are not doing anything to jeopardize or further increase the likelihood of ourselves being harmed if we're thinking that whites have been emboldened by President-elect Donald Trump. I will just state it again. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I don't think alcohol, recreational cannabis, cigarettes, I don't think any of that is going to help us solve the problem, white supremacy, racism. I think it would be best if we are lucid 24/7 as long as white supremacy exists so that we can make phenomenal decisions to keep ourselves as safe as possible. You never know when today will be the day that you bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any of these other race soldiers, badge or no. Whites are dangerous. I do not think having a beer, smoking a blunt, or whatever else, I don't think that that's going to help us deal with the most lethal force of people on the planet. The evidence certainly doesn't show that. That being said, we will be back 48 hours. Thanks for tuning in. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.